first benefit of House File 863 would be the health benefits that would come with lowering smog-producing pollutants. After New York adopted the Clean Car Act, they saw a reduction in hospitalizations of children with asthma, a decrease from 22 per thousand to 7 per thousand. A second benefit of House File 863 would be more efficient vehicles, resulting in cost savings for consumers. When vehicles are produced with technology that produces less greenhouse gas emissions, they are also more efficient, so it would cost less for consumers to fill up. The Energy Information Administration estimated that in one region, if just one state were to adopt the Clean Car Standard, the price of gasoline would drop 6 cents per gallon. In Minnesota, since Hurricane Katrina shut down refineries temporarily in the Gulf of New Mexico, and gas prices began to spike, we have agonized about gas prices and ways that we can make sure to minimize any impact on consumers of our actions. We agonized about raising the gas tax for our transportation bill. It should not be difficult for us to take an action together that will reduce the price of gas in Minnesota. These two benefits alone make House File 863 a good policy option for Minnesota. But there's a third benefit, and that is that the Clean Car Act would reduce emissions of greenhouse gases in Minnesota 13.1 million metric tons by 2025. Adopting this policy option in the transportation sector will reduce the pressure on other sectors of Minnesota's economy. As we look to the agriculture sector, the waste processing sector, the energy generation sector, those sectors would be less burdened by future actions that they would need to take. It's important that transportation takes care of its fair share. Let's get into the issue of ethanol in House File 863. House File 863 is agnostic on fuel. It is focused on air emissions, what comes out of the tailpipe. The air emissions do not tell automakers how to make vehicles cleaner and less polluting. Auto manufacturers get to decide which technology they would like to use to do that. Under the Clean Air Act, the federal government's law about air pollution in the United States, states have two choices. We can be in the federal standards, or we can choose a standard that California adopted back in the late 60s and early 70s. Washington State, Vermont, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, Oregon, New York, New Mexico, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, Connecticut, and California have the Clean Car Standard. California regulated this pollution before the federal government, and that's why they are allowed to innovate in this field, and states can choose to follow their lead. California is the only state in the country that currently has a greenhouse gas standard, and the 12 other states will have that standard too once the waiver is issued. Air emissions are regulated under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act. Fuel standards are regulated under Section 211 of the Clean Air Act. This is very important to Minnesota. As you might know, we are seeking a waiver to change our fuel standard from E10 to E20, and we are seeking a waiver under Section 211 of the Clean Air Act. This fuel standard effort that we are engaged in is totally separate from our air emissions standards issues. Under Section 211 of the Clean Air Act, in order to get a waiver so that we can start blending, selling, and using E20 rather than E10, we have to go through three different regimes of testing. First, we have to show the EPA that E20 doesn't harm engines and they have full functionality on E20. Then we have to show materials testing, that E20 doesn't corrode the materials in the fueling infrastructure and the materials that we use in producing vehicles. And then third, there's some emissions testing that needs to happen with E20 as part of that 211 waiver process. The engine testing was completed, I believe, at the University of Minnesota. The materials testing, I believe, was completed at Mankato at Minnesota State University. And the emissions testing, phase one is complete, but phase two is not yet complete. And that's the Renewable Fuels Association, in conjunction with a consultant in Fort Myers, Florida, completing that testing. Our E20 waiver process is lengthy, and the EPA will decide at some point in the future whether to give us a waiver to use E20. House File 863 and the air pollution standards we have in place now, or any air pollution standards we might adopt, have absolutely nothing to do with our 211 waiver application. You may have read in the news that the EPA denied issuing a waiver to California under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act. And the new greenhouse gas emission standards cannot be implemented until either a new president takes office, because all of the presidential candidates have said that they would issue the waiver, or a federal court overturns the EPA's decision. Minnesota is one of 17 states suing the EPA for their denial of the waiver. Again, the 209 waiver issue is a totally separate issue from our E20 waiver under Section 211, and it has no effect on it. So the question remains, do the clean car standards proposed in House File 863 have anything whatsoever to do with ethanol, either encouraging its use or discouraging its use? As I've already said, the clean car standards are agnostic about fuel. Auto manufacturers can choose which innovations to pursue, whether it's hydrogen or E85 or plug-in cars. Under the clean car standards, flex fuel vehicles do very well. In other words, when flex fuel vehicles are using E85, they already meet greenhouse gas emission standards that won't even be in place until 2016. This is because when you look at the life cycle of producing ethanol, there's less greenhouse gases in the production. So manufacturers have an incentive to produce flex fuel vehicles and sell them, but they also have an incentive to make sure that people who are buying those flex fuel vehicles are actually using E85. If they sell flex fuel vehicles and they make sure people are using E85, that will help them with their fleet-wide average, and it will allow them to sell more heavily polluting vehicles. The same is true of hydrogen or electric vehicles, and that's why I say the standard is clearly agnostic about fuel. Some people could look at the standards and say that there's an incentive for E85 fueling infrastructure, because the only way for manufacturers to get credit for selling flex fuel vehicles is to show that the vehicles are actually using E85. And that's what those of us who are proponents of ethanol and flex fuel vehicles want, people who buy the vehicles to actually use E85. Right now, under Minnesota's air pollution standards, there is no incentive for manufacturers to produce more flex fuel vehicles. If we adopt the clean car standard, because of the greenhouse gas emission standards we would have, we would now, you could say, have an incentive for manufacturers to produce and sell more flex fuel vehicles. As an ethanol advocate in the past, and I have contended that we have never lost an American soldier guarding a cornfield in the Midwest, if I had a choice between no incentive, which is what we currently have under our air pollution standards, or a standard that the auto manufacturers argue provides a flawed incentive for flex fuel vehicles in E85, I will take the flawed incentive over no incentive every day of the week. The auto manufacturers have long opposed increasing use of ethanol. They've opposed safety regulations like airbags and seatbelts. They've opposed the Clean Air Act and other air pollution regulations. And now they contend that the Clean Air Act has a flawed incentive for greater use of ethanol. I have very much appreciated my many conversations with the Minnesota corn growers and the two different ethanol producer groups, and I very much appreciate their steadfast support of Minnesota's corn and ethanol industries. In my conversations with them, the Farm Bureau, and the Farmers Union, we have worked on, they have provided me with a number of ideas for amendments to the bill to make it even more clear that we're talking about new cars and trucks. They're non-commercial vehicles. We're not ever going to regulate tractors or farm equipment or ATVs or snowmobiles under this regulation. And to also put some very clear language in the bill that would provide notice to people before any amendments would be considered. And I'd also like to make clear that we exempted street rods and collector cars. They're exempt by the terms of the bill, because generally speaking, street rods and collector cars are not model year 2012 and later. 30 years from now, we'll have to worry about the collector cars that are model year 2012. But we did specifically put in some language to exempt collector cars and street rods. So this law does not apply to used vehicles, used auto parts, cars we're driving, or street rods or collector cars. It only applies to auto manufacturers and ask them to sell cleaner and less polluting cars in Minnesota starting in 2012. Mr. Chair, today with me I have Jim Urkel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and he has a few words about the bill. We also brought Tom Paquette, who's the Executive Director of the California Air Resources Board from California. Mr. Paquette's not here to advocate for us to adopt these standards. We asked him to come in order to help us clear up the standards, or clear up the questions that people have about the standards. I'm obviously a proponent of this bill, and I'd like to see us pass it this year. But I know there's been a lot of questions, and I think it's important that we address those questions. So he's here. We also have Dr. Kittleson from the University of Minnesota. But next, I would like to go to Jim Urkel.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed any way you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. I also served on Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, Transportation and Land Use Technical Working Group. The working group proposed and the advisory group accepted a recommendation that Minnesota adopt the California Clean Car Standards as part of a package of recommendations that will get it close to, but just close to, the near-term goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions that were set by the legislature last session in the Next Generation Energy Act. In establishing the advisory group, Governor Plenty acknowledged the climate is warming and may present considerable challenges to Minnesota. It is estimated that Minnesota's climate will warm 4 degrees Fahrenheit and result in substantial shifts in its economy and ecosystem. As University of Minnesota researchers have pointed out, the average temperature difference between the northern forests of Itasca State Park and the prairies of Manoman County, just 40 miles to the west, is only about, on average, 5 degrees. Depending on the rate of change, Minnesota's economy and ecosystem could suffer catastrophic alterations. For forests, the change could kill off many species, such as white and black spruce, balsam fir, and red and jack pine. Other species may succeed in migrating north to climate that better matches their natural range of variability. For agriculture, warmer temperatures will increase soil evaporation, resulting in possible reductions in crop yields. Warmer temperatures will also allow pests and diseases to spread into Minnesota's farmland and forests. At least in the forest, we can already see the transition in the boundary waters following the July 4, 1999 blowdown. University of Minnesota researchers have been surprised that the forest communities that are rebounding reflect more the deciduous forests of the eastern United States than the coniferous forests of the north. California was very concerned about similar climate effects on its own economy and ecosystem. It estimated that warmer temperatures would reduce the snowpack in the Sierra Nevadas, which supplies water throughout the state. It would adversely affect agriculture and food production because of a lack of water and outbreaks of both disease and pestilence. It would double the number of catastrophic wildfires and damage their coastal and marine ecosystems. As a result, it adopted the greenhouse gas emission standard as part of its mobile force regulations.
They're not standing for you, Erdahl. All.
The handout that you'll be seeing shows air quality measurements in the Twin Cities. The reason I'm passing it out is because by raising temperatures, climate change will also worsen the Twin Cities regional air pollution problem. In 2001, for the first time in almost 25 years, the Twin Cities began suffering air quality alerts. Since then, each year, we've seen a number of days when the air in the region has exceeded the national ambient air quality standards. The Pollution Control Agency is carefully watching as the concentration of ground-level ozone and fine particulates increases. At present, the region is at 80% of the national standard for ground-level ozone, and that's projected to only get worse as the region gains another million residents by 2030. The public health effect of this air pollution is also substantial. Ozone and fine particulates can cause cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. A University of Minnesota study has shown that in $1999 dollars, transportation-related air pollution annually costs the region more than $750 million. that's an externality that isn't recovered in any way from the user fee that we charge on transportation like the gas tax or any of the other funding mechanisms that go into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. If the region goes into non-attainment of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for ozone, the region can expect increased business costs of between $200 and $300 million each year in and year out, until we reach attainment again. That's based on a study that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce recently did, looking at the experience of Milwaukee and extrapolating it out to the Twin Cities. The chart that you see shows the top portion shows the number of days where the air quality index identifies a number of air pollutants. They pick the one that measures the highest on each day. The chart on the top shows the number of days that each of these pollutants registered the highest reading. The chart on the bottom is probably more telling, though. It shows the air quality index, or the number of days that the air quality index was either in the good category, which is from 0 to 50 on the AQI index, or moderate from 51 to 100, or above 100 and unhealthy. And you can see in the last 10 years, the number of good days that have been registered has dropped by half, and the number of moderate days has quadrupled. And you can also see the number of days where we have air that is unhealthy for either sensitive groups or for everyone. That is projected to only get worse as we move forward, and as I say, add a million more people to the region. I'd like to hand out do another handout. Under the Clean Air Act, states, as you heard from Representative Portman, states may adopt California standards if EPA has granted a waiver to California from the Act's preemption of the field of mobile source regulation. A number of states did adopt California's low emission vehicle regulations before California began looking at greenhouse gas emissions. Since then, 12 states have adopted California's clean car standards, and at least two more are in process and will probably issue regulations within the next 2 months. The chart shows, and I'll just try and move quickly from left to right, you'll see that California is at the top. There are 12 states that have already adopted the regulations. They're waiting for EPA to grant the waiver. Once it's granted, even though they adopted it before the waiver, they will be allowed to begin implementing California's clean car standards. There are two that are in process right now, Arizona and Florida. As I say, they're walking through an administrative regulation process right now. Two more are waiting for the governor to kick off the process in Iowa and in Colorado. And four are sitting with climate change action plan recommendations similar to Minnesota. You can see the dates when they were adopted. Some of them go back for their adoption of California Clean Car Standards back in the 1990s. I also included some political information for the states, so that you can see that this has been a rather bipartisan activity. There are red states, red governors in red states, red governors in blue states, blue governors in red states, and blue on blue. It's been a completely bipartisan effort. There are 9 Republican governors that have moved forward with this and 11 Democrats. You can see the new vehicle registrations, and you can see that Minnesota kind of fits within the grouping of the states that have done this. The more interesting numbers start with the fleet mix, this is information that actually I borrowed from the National Automobile Dealers Association, although it comes from the U.S. Department of Transportation's Highway Statistics Yearbook, and it shows the breakout between cars and trucks in their fleet. And you can see that California has more cars than trucks, but it's not necessarily that much higher than many of the other states, including Minnesota. 8 states that are on the list have a smaller percentage of cars than Minnesota. And even when you look at this, you have to keep in mind a couple of things. The definition of truck or truck is taken from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which includes SUVs and minivans. And so while when people talk about trucks, particularly the auto dealers are talking about how this bill is a threat to trucks, they want you to think F-350, but really these numbers also include PT Cruisers and Grand Caravans. The other thing to keep in mind is that even though California has a lower percentage of trucks, in total numbers, California has more than 12 million trucks, and Minnesota has about 2.1 million. And so the question of why California might want to do something that would make trucks more difficult to operate in California when they have six times the number of trucks that we have, it starts to strain credibility. When you look at the state gross domestic product for both forestry and agriculture, you can see that there are five states that have larger total agriculture and forestry industries than Minnesota does. Again, California is about five or six times the level of Minnesota, and there would be no reason for them to try and do something that would threaten an industry that provides $24 billion a year of economic development or economic activity. And even those numbers, there are five that states that have the ag and forestry sectors of their economy are larger than Minnesota's, even though their numbers are smaller in total. The last two columns deal with ethanol production and consumption, and you can see that Minnesota is of all the states that are listed, is the fourth highest in terms of ethanol consumed in transportation in millions of gallons, and is third in ethanol production. And you can see California is consuming a lot more than they're producing. That represents market share or markets that Minnesota ethanol producers could be tapping. And the fact of the matter is, and you'll hear this from Dr. Fiquette, that that California the California Air Resources Board has recently adopted a resolution that allows for a shift from California's present blend of gasoline, which is E5.7, to E10, similar to or the same as Minnesota. That will require an additional 800 million gallons a year of ethanol, and that's got to come from someplace, and it might as well come from Minnesota ethanol producers. With that, I will. If there are no questions at the moment, I will introduce Tom Kiquette. He is the Chief Deputy Executive Officer of the California Air Resources Board.
And members will listen to the testimony here, and then we can offer questions in general to Representative Hortman and or her testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed as you will.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, thank you for the invitation today. My name is Tom Kiquette. I'm the Deputy Director in short term of the staff of the California Air Resources Board. And when I was invited here, I thought I'd better go to the Internet and sort of peruse what the major issues were and figure out if I could provide any value added to the debate going on in Minnesota. And so I picked up three topics that I hope will provide some information to you you'll find useful in this debate. The three are, who is the California Air Resources Board, what do we do, and is tying the future, your future, to another state any more risky than tying it to the US EPA, which is where it's tied right now. Second issue is, what implications do California's standards have on the public, the cost, and model availability? And third, is California friendly to ethanol? And is there anything in the clean car standard that we have adopted that gets in the way of Minnesota's leadership position on ethanol? So if I could go through those three, I hope it will help you in your debate. So first of all, who is the California Air Resources Board? We're a state agency, just like the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We have regulatory decisions made by a board. Those board members are appointed by the governor of California. Five of them are elected officials who represent counties, rural counties and urban counties in California. Six are specialists. They represent things like agriculture, health experts, automobile engineering, etc. The staff that I'm the deputy director for works for the board. We have several hundred engineers that work on and scientists who work on motor vehicle emissions and on climate change. High percentage of these people are degreed scientists, engineers, PhDs, and so forth. We feel that science and fact drive all of the decisions made by our board. We're closely aligned with our universities. We rely on Dr. Kittleson of the University of Minnesota for his expertise in measuring diesel emissions, so we go beyond our borders for that. Capabilities of the California Resources Board, I think, match the US EPA's in this area, and we work very closely with them. We often take the lead on one area, and they'll take the lead on another area where they perhaps have greater expertise. We set the first emission standards for cars in 1963. As a result of those emission standards, the first catalytic converters were put on cars, the first computer-controlled engines were put on into automobiles, the onboard diagnostic system that helps your car be fixed when it's broken was developed by California, the first near-zero emission car, gasoline-powered car, that we now have about 700,000 of those on our roads, was developed as a direct result of the emission standards that California set. We get all the models that you do here in Minnesota. There's no model of availability problems, big ones, small ones, etc. Trucks, cars, doesn't matter. They're all available to the California standards. And as you heard, there's 12 states have adopted our standards, chosen California cars over the higher emitting EPA version. Much of that recent interest is because of the greenhouse gas emission standards that we adopted about 3 years ago. Let me tell you a little bit about the regulatory process so that you get a sense of how these things are adopted and what happens during their implementation. First of all, we begin with extensive discussions with the automobile manufacturers. They obviously have great knowledge in this area. We visit their research facilities in Detroit, in Germany, in Japan. We test prototypes in our laboratory. We have a big facility in Los Angeles that has all the capabilities of evaluating these vehicles. We've even modified vehicles, built them ourselves at times to assure that they can meet low emission standards. We do detailed studies of cost, the impact on the economy of California. We do follow-up evaluations to assure that the cars really do work well in the public's hands. And we do enforcement, and we sometimes recall those that don't perform as well, and they get fixed. If problems arise with the regulations, we're able to act very quickly to modify the regulation. Our board meets every month. We haven't had to do that very often, but occasionally we've had to flip a date or make an appropriate technical change. All these regulatory decisions are done in a public hearing. They go for sometimes hours, sometimes for days. All the stakeholders have a chance to address our board before a decision is made. That would include, we have states that come and testify. If you ended up adopting the California standards, Minnesota's representative would be welcome to address our board on any of the activities or changes to the regulations. If a state adopts California standards, then we provide electronically all the information that they need to manage it at the state level. It's just a matter of us adding them to a listserv, which cars are certified, which ones aren't, things like that. The experience in the other states is that most they need one person to sort of manage all of this, so there's no big bureaucracy created. And then the real question, I guess, that some people have posed is what happens if after you've done this, assuming that you do it, that you have second thoughts, that we do something that maybe you don't think is the right thing, if you're not satisfied with the vehicles that are being delivered to Minnesota, the answer is pretty straightforward. You can just opt out of the program and go back to the EPA cars. So there's really not, from what we can see, not a lot of risk here. The Northeast states that have had the standards now, some of them for almost 10 years, have not found any problems in implementing them, and no one has opted back out of the standards so far. So what about the practical implications? I understand that Minnesota is now attaining clean air standards. Congratulations on that. We hope to see that in California too, although it's going to take us another 10 or 15 years. But in both cases, the progress of clean air here and in California has largely been a result of cleaner cars. There's no doubt about that. Now, in many states now, the interest, of course, has shifted to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which our clean car standards also address. Vehicles are about a third of our emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in California, and so our legislature was the one that directed us to start these clean car standards for greenhouse gases. The regulations we adopted and you are considering would reduce greenhouse gases by 30% by the 2016 model, starts in 2009 and is gradually phased in to provide lots of lead time for the automobile manufacturers. The vehicles will look no different than they do today. We set the clean car standards based on existing technologies that are available on a few cars that are not being widely used, on a few emerging technologies that will come to the market in the next few years. We set the standards based on every vehicle manufacturer being able to comply. No change in performance, no change in weight, no change in size, no change in utility. We established separate standards for cars and the pickup SUV category, and we did that so that shifts in preferences and shifts between other states, in fact, would not have effect on model availability. It's a separate requirement to clean up the trucks and a separate requirement to clean up the cars, and so the model mix doesn't really make any difference. The clean cars will cost more. By 2016, about $1,000 more per car. That's a 4% increase. But interestingly, offsetting that higher cost is substantially improved fuel economy. In fact, the savings in fuel is enough to pay back that $1,000 initial cost in 3 years at today's gasoline prices. It's enough so that the net cost of owning a vehicle during that first purchase period, 4 or 5 years, is actually $20 a month less than it would be today. And that's from the fuel savings. And then, of course, subsequent owners won't have to pay that higher cost, or at least as much of it, and will still benefit from the lower operating cost due to better fuel economy. Now, we looked at how these costs, because they do seem substantial, would impact California's economy. And we found that there would be $5 billion in increased economic growth, 50,000 new jobs in California. A lot of people shake their heads and say, well, how could that be if it costs more money to buy these cars? Well, the reason turned out to be pretty simple, despite all the complexities of these highfalutin models that we use, and you probably use too, to model your economy. Well, it boils down to simply, if you don't burn as much fuel, that's more money that stays in the state, and then people spend that money on things like going out to dinner and buying local product, and that creates jobs. And so that's how, rather than sending the money to the Middle East, that's where the economic growth comes about. And so this would benefit Minnesota, just like we believe it will benefit California. The final point, I think, just about the ethanol issue. Our legislature, like yours, passed a comprehensive climate change program, and our goal is a little bit different, but basically the same, is to return our emissions by 2020 to 1990 levels. And so as we look at how to do this, it is clear to us that biofuels, such as ethanol, will play an extremely important role in reducing transportation greenhouse gas emissions. We now have 5.7% ethanol in our gasoline. That's less than the rest of the country. Almost everybody else has E10. And this is, I think, one of the reasons that we're kind of labeled as being cool to ethanol. Well, we kept that percentage low because we did have some issues with how the blending of ethanol with our gasoline blend stock would impact emissions. But we resolved that. Our oil companies are making changes to the gasoline blend stock, and E10 will be the fuel of our future in the next few years, and it will be a clean fuel for our kind of fuel that we have in California. While we have not committed to go above 10%, for example, to E20, we are very interested in Minnesota's efforts to convince EPA to allow E20, and we hope to learn from your experience, because clearly it could benefit our greenhouse gas reduction efforts as well. We're also very interested in E85, or 85% ethanols. We have about 300,000 vehicles that are these flexible fuel vehicles that can use E85 today, and it's a growing number every year. But I'm sure you've heard we have a grand total of 3 E85 stations in California. So we're not selling much E85. These cars are running on gasoline. But that's changing. Last year, legislature provided us some funds, and we funded the development of 47 new E85 fueling stations. Legislature was happy with the way we handled that money, and this year they provided us with a continuing stream of money of $120 million a year for alternative fuels, and we expect that some of that will go to further expanding the E85 infrastructure. And then perhaps more importantly, our governor directed us to come up with a way to lower the carbon emissions that are actually in the gasoline. And we're developing that requirement now. The goal is to reduce carbon emissions by 10%. And the main way of doing this is going to be through the increased use of ethanol, at least in the short term. As a result, our oil companies will be challenged to provide more ethanol in the marketplace that can be used by the E85 capable vehicles, and this will further expand the fueling network. And what about the ethanol capable cars? That we have 300,000 or so now and growing. Question has been raised is, will these cars be able to meet the very stringent clean car standards that California has adopted? I understand that from the internet again that the auto lobbyists have said no, but that's not what their engineers are telling us, and we meet with them regularly. The technologies to assure that ethanol flexible fuel vehicles can meet the clean car standards are known. We have discussed with the auto engineers how they plan on meeting these standards. They're going to use some of the same technologies that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, so that's fortuitous. There's also other technologies available, such as air assist injectors and a few other things that are in their tool bag that allows the E85 vehicles to meet the absolute most stringent standards that are part of the California program. The engineering and problem-solving capabilities of the auto manufacturers are second to none, so we're very confident that they will be successful here in the next few years. So in summary, the California Clean Car Standards were developed after an extensive amount of assessment, which showed that they're feasible, cost-effective, and will not affect model availability in California or in any other states that adopt them. As with previous emission standards for smog, we expect the standards will be implemented smoothly and as planned. The standards will save car owners money due to better fuel economy. The less fuel use will result in a bump in the state's economy and create jobs. We're developing the infrastructure for expanded ethanol use now, and right now we're lagging Minnesota, but we expect to catch up. Nothing in the clean car standards impedes or discourages the increased use of ethanol. In fact, the California Clean Car Regulation does provide an incentive to vehicle manufacturers that produce ethanol-capable vehicles. And California and the other states that have adopted these standards believe we have an obligation to provide leadership and climate protection. Our governor has really stepped out on that. And we believe that the actions today will lead to a more effective and comprehensive national program and international program that will be needed to avoid the potential damages of climate change. So if you do end up adopting this, we are committed to working with you and would look forward to doing that. Thank you very much.
This is a good place for questions, Representative
Mr. Chair, I do have one more witness, Dr. Kittleson from the University of Minnesota, to give a little bit of testimony, and then that would be a good time for questions.
Okay. Tell your folks not to go too far away. Rock for the U of M. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. I am a professor, and we tend to speak in 50-minute modules. For that reason, I'm going to be reading a prepared statement rather than getting carried away. So
make sure you introduce yourself at the top of that statement. I know who you are.
I'm David Kittleson. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Minnesota and a fellow of the Society of Automotive Engineers. I've been doing research on improving engine efficiency and reducing engine emissions for nearly 40 years and direct all our engine research activities. Our work on renewable fuels started many years ago. We published papers on the use of alcohols and hydrogen in engines already in the 1970s. We started working with biodiesel fuel in 1994 and helped to facilitate the current B2 mandate. We also operated the biodiesel helpline for many years. We recently completed a 13-month study of E20. This was a study in which a fleet of 80 University of Minnesota vehicles tested E20 in regular gasoline, half on E20 and half on gasoline, and the study assessed drivability and reliability issues. The results of this study are part of the state of Minnesota's request for an E20 waiver. We are currently doing research on the use of ethanol in diesel and advanced low-temperature combustion engines, and we're also doing a variety of research on other biofuels, including biodiesel, raw vegetable oils, corn stover oil, algae oil, and butanol. I'm also part of a team of researchers at the University of Minnesota working on plans to meet the goals of the Minnesota Next Generation Energy Act in the transportation sector. Given this background, I was rather shocked when I heard that there was concern that adopting the California Clean Car Standard would somehow negatively impact ethanol use in Minnesota. I could see no connection, but I decided to see if I could find one. Last week, I was a participant in the Coordinating Research Council workshop on on-road vehicle emissions in San Diego. Mr. Chester France, who's the Director of Assessment Standards for the U.S. EPA, gave the keynote address. This gave me an opportunity to ask a question. His talk is focused mainly on the future of renewable fuels and transportation. So I asked him at the end if he thought that adoption of the California Clean Car Standard in Minnesota would in any way impede the use of ethanol in Minnesota. He said he could think of no reason that it would have any impact. He also said that if EPA granted the E20 waiver, it would be a legal fuel, period. Later, I talked to Mr. Alberto Ayala of the California Air Resources Board, and he's been heavily involved in putting together the Clean California Standards. Like Mr. France, he could think of no reason that the California law would limit the use of ethanol fuels. Well, my students and I continue to try and understand why there's a concern, and I'll touch on a few of the issues. The federal CAFE standards give manufacturers credit for making flexible fuel vehicles, vehicles that can burn any ethanol blend. Well, the California law requires that they not only make those vehicles, but demonstrate that they're actually using E85 or high ethanol blends to receive the credit. That puts the manufacturers in a position of actually needing to promote E85 availability, which seems to me to be a plus for ethanol. The E20 waiver requested by Minnesota asks that E20 be accepted for a fuel in existing vehicles. Flexible fuel vehicles that are brought up as perhaps becoming less available can already use any ethanol blend. And so the waiver doesn't have anything to do with flexible fuel vehicle availability. There's some concern that E85 vehicles could not meet the very stringent partial zero emission vehicle standards that are going to be taking effect. Typically, today's flexible fuel vehicles are actually cleaner after they warmed up running on ethanol than they are on gasoline. But emissions are somewhat higher in cold starts when they're running with E85. However, domestic manufacturers already plan to make PZEV, or partial zero emission flexible fuel vehicles. The tighter standards we're talking about under this act do not take effect until 2013. And by that time, advanced fuel injection systems and storage catalysts that address these cold start issues should be well in place. The bottom line to my sort of trying to understand the connection between ethanol and the California Clean Car Act is, as far as I can see, it won't impact ethanol use in Minnesota, and it actually might lead to increased ethanol use in other states. I'd also like to talk about a couple of other concerns that have been raised about the California standards. It is said that they increase fuel economy too quickly, so that it'll be difficult for manufacturers to change their fleet quickly enough to meet these standards. Well, fuel economy standards in Europe and China are already tighter than ours, rather significantly, and the vehicles built over there are actually built by more or less the same manufacturers that are making vehicles available here. We already know that large fuel economy gains are possible in SUVs and larger vehicles if you're willing to invest in the technology. For example, a Ford Escape Hybrid gives a 37% fuel economy increase compared to a standard gas, standard version of the Escape. Of course, there are people who say, well, I can't drive my truck. There's going to be a big clampdown on trucks. Well, maybe this is an extreme example, but if you want something that's really big, you can buy a Metro Transit Green Bus. Those are hybrid buses, and they are also reporting a roughly 37% increase in fuel economy compared to the buses that they're replacing. We can dramatically increase fuel economy using existing technology. Finally, there's concern that the Act is not cost-effective. Mr. Keketh has already covered that very well, but my students will be mad at me if I don't tell you what they calculated. If we assume that gasoline remains at $3.50 a gallon, and I believe it's going to actually increase, the net present value of the incremental cost of a California vehicle over a standard vehicle over the 15-year lifetime of the car, and there are many of us who drive our cars 15 years, would be $1,200 to $1,500 saving. So this is a saving of $1,200 to $1,500. If you look just at what the payback is for people who want to turn over their vehicles more quickly, we estimate the payback period on purchase would be 2 to 5 years. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Horton.
We got a note from that we have one more person. His name is Matt Baumgartner.
No,
he's from Olivia, Minnesota.
No,
he drove a far way to make us start.
We know where Olivia is, and we know the Baumgartners down there.
So Matt,
you want to come up right now?
I heard it was short.
Olivia is the corn capital, by the way, of Minnesota, for those of you that don't know. And we have the Sheep Shed Restaurant, yes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Baumgartner. I'm a citizen of rural Olivia, Minnesota. I'm here in strong support of the Minnesota Clean Cars Act. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. I was raised in rural Olivia, with the exception of 3 adolescent years spent in Arlington, Virginia, while my father worked for the George H.W. Bush administration in Washington, D.C., which, upon Bush losing the election, our family moved back to Olivia. I started working on my cousin's crop farm at age 13 for $3 an hour. I learned almost as much there as I did in school, where I graduated with honors. I went on to graduate from the University of Minnesota in 2002 with a degree in environmental science, emphasis soil science. I spent the next 4 years working in the Twin Cities for two environmental consulting firms, then moved back to Olivia with my wife and stepson settled. And I'm proud to say we're expecting a new child at any moment. It is my opinion that nothing in life, no choice, is black and white, right or wrong, but some decisions can still be made easily. Passage of the Minnesota Clean Cars Act is just such a decision. Global warming, an energy crisis, global unrest, war, and disparity are challenges we face, and they are immediate. Luckily, together, Minnesota can make a positive difference. Voting in favor of this act drives us in the right direction. The threat of global warming is real with real consequences. The poles are melting, the climate is changing, and we, all of us, are caught in the middle. Our entire civilization is built upon a known and reasonably predictable climate. So much of the critical life-giving crops and resources grown in the world are dependent upon our once stable and reasonably predictable climate. Allowing the climate to change puts far too much at risk. Exactly at a time when population worldwide is spiking, dramatically increasing demand for all resource types. Global warming is the issue. Without adequately addressing global warming, nothing else matters very much. Imagine a world where desperation for basic human needs, water, food, shelter, radically dominates. Where governments lose control for the sprawling, desperate needs. Then look to Central Africa, Darfur, Sudan, Niger. Look to those millions in Peru, dependent upon dwindling water supplies from shrinking glaciers. Then look at Los Angeles and their efforts to pipe water from the mountains. Look here in Minnesota to last year's historic, last year's low water marks in Lake Superior to midsummer drought followed by massive rain events, flooding. No longer is it okay. No longer can I sit idly. The facts are in, events are taking place and shaping up. The time to act is now. We have the time if we change. So let us consider the Minnesota Clean Cars Act. Let us consider greenhouse gases belched by your truck and my truck. Let's consider the consumer. Let's consider imported energy. We as Minnesotans, as Americans, as citizens of the world, must reduce our carbon footprint, our environmental impact. Our very way of life may on it depend. What greater motivation can I testify? As consumers, for too long, we have been told it's too hard, it doesn't exist, or it's too expensive. Foolishness. Necessity is the mother of all invention, and necessity has brought us more than adequate choices for the challenges, changes asked for in the Minnesota Clean Cars Act. We have the know-how, we have the technology, and 12 other states already realize this fact. About 3 years ago, my good friend went looking to buy his new full-size truck. He found what he wanted on the Chevy website, a flex fuel E85 grain truck. He went to two different dealerships looking to order his new truck, where he was informed that the option was an extra $3,000, and when he said, okay, I'll pay, the dealers had to admit they were unable to sell him that truck. It was not available. When you ask your consumer, do you want to get better mileage in your vehicle of choice? Do you want to save money? Do you want to be a better steward of the environment? You'll be hard-pressed to find any answer but yes. Not one person I know wishes their truck got worse mileage. Automakers must be told we demand better. The same old garbage will not do. Give us better choices. And Detroit should do it quickly before Toyota eclipses them. We as Americans depend on other countries to supply a huge amount of our energy. Many of these countries don't like us. We are beholden to their whims and trifles. America is politely walking up the gallows and putting a noose around its own neck. Let's stop this madness and change. If the solutions to the issues I have spoken about were found on an apple tree, let us pick the low-hanging fruit. Let us make the easiest changes first. Let us pass the Minnesota Clean Cars Act. I did not come here expecting that I could change all of or influence all of your votes in favor of the Minnesota Clean Cars Act. But luckily, in this country, I'll get my chance to vote too. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your time. Before he leaves, is there any questions to Mr. Baumgartner? All right. Thanks for the testimony.
I have copies of... Anyway.
Very good. Yeah, if you'd leave those with the page, we can make copies and get them out later to folks. Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take some questions now. I'll start. Representative Hortman, just looking at the bill, to you or any of the witnesses, I see you exempt a number of things. Must not include zero-emission vehicle standards contained in California. Must not include the 15-year, 150-mile extended warranty. If California standards are extended to off-road vehicles, all-terrain, snowmobiles, boats, aircraft, et cetera, then this is no longer in effect. Are we able to just pick and choose which California rules we don't want to follow so we can look at the whole menu of points and issues? And you've picked three for sure here. Are we able to then, as a body, at this point, say we don't want to apply this or this or this to our standards?
Mr. Chair, under the federal law, which is the Clean Air Act, Section 177, we're allowed to adopt the standards for motor vehicles that are in place in California, and our standards must be identical to theirs. One of the states that adopted their standards rejected the zero emission vehicle program, and that issue was litigated, as my understanding, and the courts did decide that that was severable. And so that's why we severed that piece. In Oregon is where they altered the warranty provision, and that was also litigated and found to be okay. And the reason why we listed all those things that it doesn't apply to is that by the terms of the bill, it applies only to new passenger cars and trucks. But no matter how many times we say that, people weren't feeling comfortable with that. And so even though it's redundant and unnecessary, I'm happy to list those things to which it does not apply. And I've drafted an amendment that adds even more things that it doesn't apply to, and that restricts the definition so that we're not referring to motor vehicles, which is problematic in Minnesota law because we have ATVs that are motor vehicles, and makes it even more clear what we're trying to accomplish with this bill.
So, Representative Portman, if we would exempt other areas of the CARB, we'd actually have to then test that in court. Is that right?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Okay. How do we monitor compliance?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the PCA would enforce the law. In the other states, my understanding is in every state except for New York, they have one staff person enforcing the law.
And, Representative, how do we do that? How is this? I don't know how many cars there's in Minnesota today, and I don't know how many will be there by 2020. How do we enforce that automobile by automobile? A lot of people burn different fuels, modify engines, do other things. How do we monitor what's coming out of our cars?
Mr. Chair, the burden is on the manufacturers to report compliance. And Mr. Kiquette may be able to speak to beyond that, but the manufacturers, say for example, I'm GM, I come to the PCA and report how many vehicles and what types I sold in Minnesota. And I don't say specifically I sold, 1,800 GMC Sierras. I report categories. So a vehicle is assigned a category, and then they will let us know how many of each category that they sold.
And if I could add, the cars come with a label. If you look underneath the hood of the car, you'll see that it says meets EPA standards, or in California it says meets California standards. In some cases, they meet both. That simple label determines whether the car is in compliance. So it doesn't really take much to determine. All the technical stuff, all the listings, all the legal things that we give to the manufacturer saying it's okay to sell this stuff, that we just make that available on the internet if anybody needs it. But in general, it's pretty self-enforcing.
And Mr. Kiquette, maybe while you're answering questions, testimony was that it would be about $1,000 a car difference by 2016 is your estimate. What's the difference today? And what was the difference when you first enacted the California standard, California versus other cars?
Well, for the smog standards, the difference today, I think, is essentially zero. There's perhaps some cost, maybe $200 in the car, but there doesn't seem to be any pricing difference between the federal car and the California car. At various times in the past, manufacturers have put a $75 or $100 sticker on the side of the window that says, just like you buy a fancy interior and it says California emission standards, $75 or $100. That's all that's happening right now. As the greenhouse gas standards come in, however, there'll be more changes to the vehicles, and we expect that for the 2012 models, it'll be about $300 increase, and then for the 2016 models, it'll be the $1,000 increase.
All right. How about another question from me? We talked a lot about flex fuel vehicles and burning the different grades of ethanol. What about non-flex fuel vehicles burning the different grades of ethanol? One of the things we're going to see a lot of in this state in the future are what we call blender pumps. Recent studies at our own University of Minnesota, Mankato, and not University, Mankato State, whatever it's called now. It used to be really easy, but now they've changed the name. Minnesota State, Mankato, as well as North Dakota, actually show an increase in fuel efficiency at the mid-grade levels of ethanol. And frankly, a lot of people today, and a lot of people since the day E85 pumps hit Minnesota, once their cars come off warranty, they do run. They will try and will, in many cases, run an ethanol blend above the 10% in their vehicles, and they're not flex fuel vehicles. So how do we handle that under the CARB?
Well, under the clean car standards, there's really no relationship at all. I mean, the cars are what they are, and if they run on a different fuel, that's strictly up to the consumer, I guess, and if it's going to be approved by anybody, it's by EPA, not us. All of our compliance testing assumes a fixed test fuel, and that's all we look at. Our fuel has E10 in it. If you're successful with E20 or 30, I think we would probably be quickly following in your footsteps.
What's the difference in greenhouse gas? You talk about the greenhouse gas emissions coming and other things. What is the difference in the standards set by CARB versus the new energy standards set out in Washington, the 35 mile per gallon CAFE standards? I mean, I understand if we wouldn't have set that, but now that that's coming, when we get to the 35 as well as then the same day on CARB, what will be the difference on that date?
Well, on the 2016 date, which is when these standards are fully into effect, they'll provide about double the greenhouse gas emissions as the federal standard. And by 2020, when the federal fuel economy standard goes into place, I believe it's about 70 to 80% more emissions than GHG or greenhouse gas emission reductions than the federal program. And that's documented in a report.
70% more than the 35 mile a gallon federal standard.
No, it's the cumulative emissions. If you want to look at it in terms of actual fuel economy, I think the cars will be about equivalent. These aren't exact comparisons because fuel economy doesn't perfectly relate to carbon dioxide emissions, but the car numbers would be closer to the low 40s. And the truck numbers would be very similar to the to the federal standards. But we're guessing because the federal government hasn't adopted the standards yet. All they've said is that it needs to be 35. They haven't said what it's going to be for trucks, what it's going to be for cars, or what the interim standards are before 2020. So we're making somewhat of a guess. But it's clear that the California standards will do a lot more in terms of reducing greenhouse gases in that period.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that. The carbon dioxide that comes out of the tailpipe is mostly a result of the fuel that's burning in the car and the efficiency of the engine. But there's another very potent greenhouse gas emission that comes from automobiles, and that's the air conditioning refrigerant. And right now, the air conditioning refrigerant that we all have in our cars is 1,300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. The federal standard doesn't look at all or provide any incentive for there to be innovation in air conditioning refrigerants.
And last question for me, and then I have a number of members that have questions here. I guess one of the things that I'm trying to understand, and you brought it up, but the only way to veto apparently what the cardboard does is just to opt out of the entire program. And I think for myself and others, one of the problematic things that we're trying to understand here is why we would allow a governor-appointed, you know, in California board to dictate what goes on in Minnesota, and our inability, obviously, to hold anyone accountable. In California, I could not vote for the governor, or I could not vote for a legislator if they're overseeing the EPA that's taking care of those standards there. But we don't have such a luxury, and frankly, even if and obviously there was a fight on the zero emission standards, and as I read March 28th, the Sacramento Bee, there was a big dust up over your hydrogen versus electric vehicle cars, and the board actually decided to move in the direction of more hydrogen related cars, and you have Plug in America and a number of car manufacturers for electric cars protesting out there, your meeting, and other things. And frankly, if we weren't exempting those types of things, that would be exactly the scenario that would, I think, understandably cause some concern for us to just make a wholesale change. Representative Hornstein and others, Osment and others here, had really pushed for electric hybrid cars and plug-in cars in our future, and all of a sudden you change a direction out there on a specific vehicle to get towards your zero emission standards. But again, I don't know how we rectify that in my mind, Representative Hortman or anyone else up there that wants to answer on how we go about holding someone up for accountability besides getting on a plane and traveling, which Magnus and I like to do. besides going to that expense of monitoring and traveling across country for these meetings, how do we, so our only recourse then is to just opt out at the time they do something like that that we're upset at. So every year we'll have an amendment during our omnibus bill to opt out of this if someone's mad. Is that how this will work?
Well, Mr. Chair, the regulatory process takes about 2 years before any changes can be made, because whenever California makes any change, they have to apply to the EPA for a waiver. And so there's about a one-year period when it's in development in the state, and then there's another one-year period, generally speaking, waiting for the EPA. But what I'm having the page bring around to members is a proposed amendment that our pollution control agency that would be implementing this law would give immediate notice to the governor, the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture, the commissioner of commerce, and the ranking member and chair of the Ag Finance and Policy Committees and the committees that deal with commerce, to give them notice of any anticipated amendments. That way we could see what's coming down the road and we can prepare for it well in advance of when any change actually occurs.
Dr. Kittleson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just a short comment. Right now, I'm not sure that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is necessarily particularly responsive to the needs of Minnesota either.
I'd agree with that, Dr. Kittleson, but I can call Colin Peterson, my representative, or Coleman or Klobuchar, and bang, bang, bang on them and try and hold them accountable for the actions. I can't do that with... I can call the governor's office. I suspect I won't get far in California on that. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions, and you, they've kind of been answered, but I just want to just clarify them a little bit. I guess I have some concerns about if a car dealer wants to buy a car from out of state, or if a customer wants to buy a car from out of state, is that a possibility or not? Also wondering about quotas on pickups. Will we have quotas on pickups if this goes through, or will we be able to sell as many pickups as we want to? I also am concerned about the increased miles per gallon. Is there some magic bullet that you guys have, or is just going to be thou shalt do this and it's going to happen overnight? And so if you would address those, I'd appreciate it.
Three questions there. I don't know who wants to take them in what order. Used cars. I live in Moorhead as a dealer after this goes into effect, and I go to the Fargo Auto Auction where they do not have the CARB standard on their new cars or their year-old cars or whatever. Are we allowed to trade and move those cars into our fleet?
Well, I think first on used cars, it doesn't affect that. So
well,
we only affect new cars.
After your, well, what's your definition of new? How many miles on it?
For us, it's under our state law, it's 7,500 miles.
Okay. Well, that,
but that's a,
I don't know what it is
price
here.
Would be your choice as to what that would be. The experience with the car exchanges between states that have California standards and ones that don't is perhaps best by looking at the New York and Northeast area where they've had the standards for a while. This issue came up, but they're reporting at least that there simply doesn't seem to be any problem. I think if there's a strong trade demand between neighboring states, one with California cars, one without, then the state without, can that dealer can order California cars to try to meet their needs. The flip side of it, though, of course, is that it does cause more of the cars that are purchased to be purchased in the state. You can't, California, you have to buy a car in California. And so that is a strengthening argument for the business of the new car dealers. On the goal for light-duty trucks, it's strictly a performance standard. It's measured in grams per mile of CO2 equivalent. And so there's no quota per se at all. It's as long as whatever number of vehicles are sold by a given manufacturer in the light truck SUV category meet a specified number, then that's all that's required. So if they sell, you know, 500,000 of them that all meet it, that's fine. If they sell 100,000, that's fine. The volume doesn't have anything to do with it as long as the mix of all the trucks and SUVs sold comply. So some could be higher than the standard, some could be lower than the standard. That's the flexibility that's built into the performance standard of the rule. And on fuel economy, you know, I don't think any of it's going to occur overnight. We adopted this rule in 2004, and the first compliance date is 2009, and it's not fully implemented until 2016. So that's 12 years from the time we acted to get manufacturers to get to the point where there's a 30% greenhouse gas reduction and somewhat similar fuel economy improvement. So a lot of lead time provided because we don't want to see the manufacturers tear up existing products and throw them out the window and put a new one in tomorrow. We want to see them do this as they normally evolve their engines and their vehicles through different product changes. They can make the changes needed for lower greenhouse gases at that time, and that saves a lot of money and hassle.
There. Two points I just want to add.
Hartman?
To put on my junkyard hat, at John's Auto Parts, we buy 3,500 vehicles a year at auto auction. And believe me, if I didn't think that this was good for people who buy cars at auto auction, I wouldn't be carrying the bill. The second thing is, with regard to out-of-state purchases, we talked about the idea of exempting out-of-state purchases, but I don't think the Minnesota auto dealers really want us to exempt out-of-state purchases from this law.
Are you done, Representative
Fowler? Let me just follow up.
Representative Fowler.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I guess that the answer that you gave me on the pickups and the trucks seemed a little bit wiggly, maybe is the right word. Do you have a better explanation? In California, do you ever have quotas on how many pickups can be sold? Do you ever have that there?
No.
There's never been quotas on pickups there at all?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. In the spirit of multiple questions, I just have a dozen here that I'll ask. Actually,
easy.
You've already asked a few of my questions, so I'll just one short one here. We're going to be...
And Representative Erdahl, obviously there's a list of people coming that will give another side of some of these, too, as witnesses develop. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I was going to touch on that. I see that they will have a couple of people from the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I'm sure they'll be giving us another side to this. And I'm assuming that in California you had a similar organizations that raised objections as you proposed to bring this bill forward. What is their reaction today? How are they with what you're doing today?
Mr. Fichta?
Well, I think you'll probably have to ask them because one of the representatives lives in Sacramento that's here today, so he could probably give you that answer. Right.
Okay. Representative Magna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had some other questions, but I want to ask one first of Representative Hartman. You just said that you weren't going to exempt out-of-state purchases?
Well, Mr. Chair, I suspect that the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association would not like an amendment like that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought I asked you the other day on the floor, Representative, if out-of-state purchases were covered on this. And you said, no, I could buy a car out-of-state, no problem.
Absolutely, you can. But it has to be a car that meets the standards. If you want to buy a car that doesn't meet the standards, that would be where we'd be getting into talking about exemptions.
Oh.
Representative Magna.
Okay, that confuses me even more now. Because I understood the other day that if we could, because again I said, my county doesn't have a new car dealership. We've got to go outside of the county to buy a vehicle. We haven't figured out how to unload our bees and corn out of them buses, green buses that aren't up here either. We'll figure out how to do that up there a lot better. Mr. Chairman, a question I've got, and I'm trying to figure this out too. In the bill, on line 2.7, it says our rules must be identical to and must incorporate the California rules. And I thought we were going to see some amendments that changed that, according to Representative Hortman's answer to your question. I think you asked her that. First question you asked, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Magnus. Under the federal law that's cited in that section, Title 42, Section 7507, which is the same thing as Section 177 of the Clean Air Act, states are only permitted to do exactly what we've described there, to adopt identical standards.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a question of Mr. Cackett. How often do the does the CARB, California Air Resources Board, change the rules? Once a year or
Mr. Cackett.
A couple of years? Or when typically do they do that, sir?
Over time, of course, we've been tightening the smog rules to try to deal with our air pollution problem, and I would guess that they've changed for cars, the passenger vehicles, maybe anywhere from every 3 years to every 4 or 5 years. I mean, sometimes there are minor technical things, but a major change to the rules usually occurs on that kind of frequency.
Okay, so not a frequency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to figure out, I don't know just how their rules are now, but Mr. Cackett, does the CARB organization, do they rule on total emissions or on each specific emittance, for example, sulfur dioxide or volatile organic compounds? How are the rules set up? Is it on total emissions or each specific one?
Okay. There's a emission standard for each of the relevant pollutants. So at the current time, the significant ones are unburned hydrocarbons, oxides of nitrogen, and now, starting in 2009, what we call carbon dioxide equivalent, which is carbon dioxide plus the related greenhouse gases. Those are the principal ones.
So, Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear, one of the things you regulate is the nitrous oxide emissions then.
For a greenhouse gas, that's part of the CO2 equivalent, nitrous oxide.
Right.
That's the laughing gas one. The other one, nitrogen oxides, is the smog-forming one, and we have a separate standard for that.
Okay.
Magnus?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand the bill, it basically would exempt then any of the rulemaking process we'd have here in Minnesota. I certainly have concerns about that. I wonder what opportunity citizens would have for input on the rules the CARB board puts together.
We have... After the staff has done its work developing a proposal, which is a proposed emission standard, that goes out for public comment for a 45-day period, and then our board holds a public hearing, which can go as long as there are witnesses to speak, and they go for an hour or for days, and everyone's listened to, and then the board has a public discussion of what they want to do, either yes, no, or modify, and their action adopts the rule, and then following that, there's another process to make sure it's met all the administrative requirements, that if there's any legal issues that we missed, it goes through that kind of a review and finally adopted as a regulation. So there's a lot of public comment, and if the board makes any changes, it goes back out for more public comment.
That's similar to the EPA's rulemaking process right now. When the EPA, if they were to change anything in the program that we're currently in, they issue rules, and then they have a period of public comments, and then after public comments, then they issue the regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I don't know how much what the budget is of the board, but I'd sure appreciate it if they come to Minnesota and took some public testimony on proposed rule change, too, if we could fly the California folks in here. Or drive them on a hybrid or something out here and take some public testimony
Has that ever been done? Have you gone to other states to take testimony that are under the California rules? So again, as Representative Magnus said, you know, citizens are you know, not always easy to travel to California. You bring your board or your staff out here ever for comment?
No, we haven't. The best we're able to do is we do webcast them all, so there's both video and audio available to anybody who has access to the internet.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Kittleson had some response to a prior question.
Dr. Kittleson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just to follow up on this web-based thing, if you're interested in what's going on in California, it's an extremely open process, and one can participate on the web very, very easily. But that isn't the main point I wanted to make. It was a follow-up on an earlier question, and that is availability of technology. I think we forget what we've done in the past. Under the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, which is a partnership between the federal government and the automakers between 1992 and 2000, there was a target of taking a full-size Ford Taurus and tripling its fuel economy, and doing that with no compromise to passenger carrying capacity, no compromise to performance, and so on. And so the big three automakers took this on. They tried to get 85 miles per gallon with no compromise in other ways. Well, unfortunately, they failed. They only ended up with between 70 and 80 miles per gallon in a Ford Taurus-sized vehicle with no compromise to performance. We know how to do it. We've known how to do it for a long time. And it doesn't mean we make smaller vehicles. And so technology is there. It's just a matter of having the will to implement that technology. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one final question. I'm still concerned about the out-of-state purchases, and I'm wondering how we're going to regulate that. And are we going to... I see in the fiscal note it's about $200,000 for the first year and then goes down to $125,000. I'm not sure how we're going to regulate those out-of-state purchases. I got a lot of people in my district, and I know Representative Peterson's district going to Watertown or Brookings or whatever along the border, and they go out and buy cars out of state because, as I said, a lot of us don't have new car dealerships in our county, and I wonder how many folks we're going to hire and who's going to pay the bill for monitoring this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Portman.
And Representative Magnus. Currently, when you buy a car out of state, you need to title it in Minnesota. And that would be the same thing under this standard. You would have to title your vehicle in Minnesota. And if you bought a car that was non-compliant, you wouldn't be allowed to title it here. So that's how it's enforced. But citizens would have, we have a, you know, 4-year lead time here to educate citizens to buy the cars that are certified to the standard. And my understanding is that in Nevada, which is adjacent to California but has not adopted the standard, what happens is that manufacturers deliver cars that are California certified so that there isn't a border problem.
And one of the problems we have, just so folks understand, is we don't have multiple metro areas of Minnesota. We really just have one, the Seven County Metro. Most other states have California, Ohio, others have multiple areas. So if you live in Southwest Minnesota, odds are, a lot of your larger dealers are in Sioux Falls, or if you live there in Fargo, in the west central part of the state, and yes, they can come down to Twin Cities or to St. Cloud or somewhere to buy their vehicles, but they're too far away to get service and other things, so they're going across the border to these larger cities in states that are not necessarily CARB states at this point, so that is a concern. Representative Morrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I find myself on the horns of the drum because I very much want to support this legislation, and found myself reading a thesis, a master's study on the California standards, because there is a question I'd like to direct to Mr. Cotet, and it concerns the 85 vehicles. And Professor Kittleson, I have a Ford Taurus out in the garage, and maybe we can work on its gas mileage later. It's an 85 Ford Taurus. Mr. Cotet, my concern is I'm reading a letter of yours from March 12, 2008. Directed to Senator John Marty, and it reads, "Our objective is to see that E85 is actually used." That would be my objective too. I'd love to see E85 actually used. This letter, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it, focuses on the question of biofuel use rate, or BUR, as I've now learned. A manufacturer, I'm now quoting again, must submit data showing that the fuel is being used in its vehicles, and I think you suggest three ways. One is a survey of owners, a second way is an onboard computer, and a third way is maybe an OnStar type computer reporting system. But my understanding, so my first question is, am I correct in understanding that for a manufacturer to get credit, if you will, for the E85 vehicle sale, we need to show actual E85 use by the end user?
Mr. Fischer?
Yes.
And if the three ways to do that are survey, the three ways that you suggest are survey, onboard computer, or an OnStar type reporting system?
Mr. Fischer?
Yes, that was the three ways I suggest. I presume there might even be more, but those seem like practical ways of doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Kikett. I want to make sure I'm understanding this. The study or the thesis suggested that an alternative was, I think it was annual aggregate biofuel use rate, to take the amount of biofuel sold in a state, maybe divide it by the number of V85 vehicles, and that gives you an average biofuel use rate. Does California allow an annual aggregate approach?
The reason we didn't pursue that is because the credit goes to individual manufacturers. So if one manufacturer is very aggressive at promoting the use of E85 in the vehicles, arguably they could get more credit than if another manufacturer that doesn't. If we did it on an aggregate basis, we'd have to divide it equally. If that's what all the manufacturers wanted, they were all putting in a similar effort, we could do that.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up, keep this brief. I've noticed on this one sheet, I think you mentioned, Mr. Kikett, that California may have around 321,000 flex fuel vehicles. I'm not sure of the date of this. I believe this is 2005 vehicle registration. But I think you also mentioned about 300,000 flex fuel vehicles. Is that number approximately correct?
Yeah, I believe I said more than 300,000. It's growing every day, but I don't know the exact number.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kikett, I'm really not meaning to grill you. I'm really trying to understand this. Are many of those vehicles owned fleet vehicles by the state of California, University of California, and other public entities?
Well, not many of them, because I don't think they own that many vehicles, but they do buy flex fuel vehicles in order to comply with the Federal Energy Act that requires state agencies to buy, I think, 3 out of every 4 vehicles to be non-petroleum, and E85 flex fuel vehicles qualify for that. And they've come under considerable criticism recently because they bought them and there wasn't any fuel. And already Caltrans, which is our transportation agency that has the largest number of them, has been installing E85 stations and directing that they be fueled only on E85 unless none's available.
Maybe I'll just state it as a statement at this point, Mr. Kikett, and you could respond. My understanding in California is that California can measure E85 use with fleet vehicles that have their own pumps, and the E85 is pumped into that vehicle. Maybe a little bit more difficult when it's a rental car vehicle. We don't know where the renter takes, the lessee takes the vehicle. But in Minnesota, we have a different situation. We have a very large general public-owned, my Ford Taurus is out in the garage type of vehicle. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to actually know whether a vehicle user is using E85, given the large general public E85-owning population. Do we have a compliance problem under the current California standards with that scenario?
No, I don't think so, because all that would be required is some kind of survey. Now, when we talked about the onboard computer, I don't think we expect that every car that's an FSV has to report some kind of information to figure out how much fuel. You just need a sample. And an auto manufacturer, you know, could offer an incentive to certain owners and say, if you're willing to report this or let me pull it off your computer, like free oil change or whatever it is, and it only takes, you know, a relatively small number of cars to figure out what that model is, how much ethanol it's using. This is doesn't have to be precise and exact. We're trying to provide an incentive here, not a strong 3-digit answer.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Dunkey and Mr. Kikett. I have a few questions for you. First of all, does California currently have a standard in place which requires you to have different vehicles than other states?
Do you have a different emission standard in place right now that affects your fleet compared to all other states?
Mr. Kirkett.
Not compared to all other states, but compared to most states, yes. There's us and five other states that require California cars today, and those have to meet a more stringent emission standard for smog emissions.
Okay, and I welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And out of those five states, are all five of those states being supplied with the same makes and models of automobiles that are supplied to all other states?
That's your question.
I believe the answer to that is yes.
I'm welcome.
Okay. Well, I think that's an important point for all of us to keep in mind as we move forward on this, that if Minnesota was to adopt these standards, and I don't know where I'm going to go yet on this bill because I have a lot of questions, but if California already has standards in place and the auto manufacturers are sending the same vehicles to California as they're sending to all the other states and they're meeting the requirements, then if we move forward with this and adopt these new standards, California is going to be supplied with those same cars that all the other states are being supplied with at this time. So the cars are going to be out there, they're going to be available, and what you're telling me is that California consumers have the same choices as all other consumers. Is that correct or yes?
Yes, that's true. The cars, but when you say all other states, right now it's five other states. They get California cars, and we
right.
get California cars. And that number will expand in 2012 to about 12 other states. They will get the cars. The rest of the states will either get EPA-certified cars, or some manufacturers choose just to make one car for the nation anyway, particularly the smaller volume manufacturers, and that would be the California car.
Representative Wells.
All right, at least one other follow-up. Mr. Kirkett, to just understand this and just get clarification on what you were talking about before, if a car is manufactured and the manufacturer shows that it will meet the emissions requirements for the car as it's built and it can use E10, if the consumer wants to use E20 or E30 or whatever other blend might be, that does not matter under the current law as you've passed it, because we're talking about a different fuel being used, but that car is actually manufactured and meets those standards, and that's what counts, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. And then finally, the flex fuel vehicles, just to clarify this, the E85, so if the cars are manufactured to use E85 and they were to use some other blend, that does not matter as long as the manufacturer has said that they're going to they get the requirement and the okay for being E85 and they meet the standards.
That's right. They can operate on E0 through E85 and any blend in between.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hamilton, Magnus, and then we'll try and move on down the list of testifiers. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirkett, you talked about the makeup of the board. How would somebody, or what is the possibility of somebody from Minnesota to be appointed to that board? What's the possibility, and how would somebody go about?
Mr. Kirkett, any outside of California residents ever appointed to the board?
No, I think they're all California, and they're appointed by our governor, and I'm not aware of anybody living outside that area that's been appointed.
Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Mr. Kirkett or maybe Dr. Kittleson. You know, we're doing a B20 mandate effort here in the state now, and that's why I asked the questions about which emissions you were regulating. And do you see? Do either of you see anything in the rules you have currently out in California that would prohibit the B20 effort here?
I don't believe there's anything in our rules that would prohibit the use of that. The legal challenge, I think, is getting the waiver that the state has applied for to U.S. EPA, that it would not directly affect us at all.
So, Mr. Chairman, the regulations you have on NOx emissions wouldn't hinder biodiesel development.
No, they are determined prior to a model being sold and after for compliance purposes using a standardized test fuel and not E20 or anything else like that. It's a standard fuel that's used to determine compliance before and after the vehicle is sold.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, last minute question.
Just real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coquette, I'm kind of curious. Most of our testifiers come from within Minnesota. Could you share with us who is paying, which organization is paying for you to come to testify to us today?
Mr. Coquette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which is an organization comprised of, I believe, over 50 environmental groups who support the legislation.
All right, thank you. All right, with that, we'll dismiss you. I have Molly Schultz, and then we'll go into our second list of people kind of on the other side. Is Molly here? Or
Mr. Chair, we can skip Molly because
Molly's
all
okay.
Of us did such a
all
good
right.
job.
And I bring up Eric Hyland to introduce a couple of people.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Eric Hyland, and I'm with Mezzaline Kramer, and today I'm representing the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 car and light truck manufacturers, including BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi Motors, Porsche, Toyota, and Volkswagen. With me today is Laura Dooley and Steve Douglas with the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers, and Jim Ellman from General Motors Corporation, and hopefully they'll be able to provide you with a lot of answers to some of the questions that have already been discussed.
All right. We'll let them come up whatever order they want, or all together, or have a seat by Representative Hortman, and introduce yourself and for the tape and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Dooley, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, as Eric said. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today and encourage you to oppose House File 863, which calls for the implementation of the California Low Emission Vehicle Standard, or what we in the industry call CalEV. Let me just start off by saying that the automobile industry shares the goals of House File 863. As an industry, we spend billions of dollars annually on research and development of vehicles in order to bring innovative, clean, and efficient technologies to the market. In today's market, there's over 62 different models of alternative fuel vehicles, which includes clean diesels, hybrids, and E85 or flex fuel vehicles, which we've been talking about a lot today. Nearly 12 million of those vehicles are already on the road, with almost 200,000 alone in Minnesota. Because of this commitment, we supported the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, or HR6, on Capitol Hill last year. In fact, it was the Alliance's strong support in Congress that actually was very instrumental in passing HR6. So while we share the goals of House File 863, we disagree on the methods of achieving them. The Alliance and automobile industry supports an aggressive, comprehensive, and national approach to the climate change issue. We strongly encourage you to oppose CalEV, which virtually will eliminate incentives for E85 vehicles, which relinquishes Minnesota's authority to California and establishes a patchwork of constantly changing regulations. Going back to HR6, I just wanted to talk about some of the benefits that are associated with it. The centerpiece, essentially, of HR6 was an unprecedented 40% increase in corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE standards, by the year 2020. That increase will result in a 30% reduction in CO2, or greenhouse gas emissions. In addition, HR6 reduces our nation's dependence on foreign oil and increases the production of clean and alternative fuels as well. By 2020, HR6 is estimated to save 18 billion gallons of gasoline per year compared to estimated consumption levels, and that's about the equivalent of taking 30 million vehicles off the road. HR6 also requires the U.S. to produce 21 billion gallons of advanced biofuels such as cellulosic ethanol. The U.S. EPA also recognized the industry's commitment to this goal by supporting the strong national program put in place by HR6. By denying California's request to implement its own fuel economy regulations as part of the existing CalEV program. This action prohibits California and all other states from implementing CalEV's proposed fuel economy regulations. So in the wake of EPA's decision, Minnesota's proposal to adopt Pell-Lev as required in the bill before you would mean that the state is only implementing a smog and ozone-forming emissions program that provides no environmental benefit above and beyond the federal government's existing smog and ozone-forming program. Let me reiterate, there is no environmental benefit associated with the California program when it comes to smog or ozone-forming emissions. My colleague Steve Douglas will get into a little bit more detail on that in a while. So with that being said, and all the developments at the federal level, the Alliance believes that California is the wrong public policy choice for the following reasons. Number one, adoption of Pell-Lev will not support the state's commitment to E85 technology and infrastructure. The California standards will constrain the sale of E85 vehicles. And I know you've heard otherwise before, but Steve Douglas and Jim Elman from GM will go through in detail why that is in fact true. Of the 13 states already, and that includes California, that have adopted the Pell-Lev program, none of those states have the ethanol commitment that Minnesota has made. In fact, Minnesota is the first quote-unquote ethanol state that's going down this path. The second reason, number two, the California program will result in product assistance. If the fuel economy waiver is received in January, as was previously mentioned, you're looking at implementing a program that goes too far, too fast. Now, what do we mean by saying too far, too fast? In comparison, Europe was brought up before. Europe, they look at about a 2% per year increase in fuel economy. Comparatively, HR 6, while we don't know the exact regulations yet, we predict that it will require about a 4% increase in fuel economy per year. The California program calls for a 13% increase in fuel economy in 1 year, followed by a 14.5% increase in fuel economy the next year. And like I said, that's too far, too fast for manufacturers to meet. The only cost-effective way to comply with California's program is to restrict the sale of specific vehicles, particularly larger cars, light trucks, and SUVs, the latter of which Minnesota residents favor. Number three, significant reductions in vehicle choice will disproportionately impact Minnesota because of its unique market. As was previously mentioned, California is a state that prefers cars to light trucks, at about 49% trucks to 51% passenger cars. Minnesota is the opposite. Minnesota consumers purchase 55% trucks to 45% passenger cars. A national standard allows the industry to balance disparities in the sales market between states that favor cars and states that favor trucks across the entire nation. The California standard does not allow us to do that. We have to hit specific California requirements in each state individually. You've heard before that product restrictions haven't come into play. There are other states that have even a wider disparity between the truck and car ratio have adopted California and moved forward. Well, the truth of the matter is none of those states have had to implement AB 1493 or the fuel economy portion yet. So we don't know what the impact will be. But our manufacturers are telling us that the only way or the likely way that they will meet these standards is those product restrictions. And finally, Minnesota should not cede its authority to California. The Pell-Lev program is a California program designed by California legislators and regulators, none of whom are accountable to Minnesota. Minnesota is a vastly different state from California, and it should not be having decisions made in Sacramento. And SOAR 6 applies a high standard to all 50 states that is good for both consumers and for energy security. Previous testimony has chastised the auto industry for sins of the past, but that is not applicable here today. The industry has moved forward in producing standards that are aggressive and that we are going to see challenged to meet, but we're committed to doing so. In turn, we also believe that states have an important role to play in addressing transportation sector greenhouse gas emissions as well as air quality standards. The best way for the state of Minnesota to improve its air quality is to get older, higher-emitting vehicles off the road. A new car is a clean car. And fleet modernization programs are the types of programs that will actively improve Minnesota's air quality. In addition, incentivizing the purchase and use of alternative fuel and advanced technology vehicles is an excellent way for Minnesota to see reductions in its greenhouse gas sector. Our engineers have been handed a very challenging mandate to achieve an average fuel economy of 30 miles per gallon across all 50 states by 2020 through HR 6, and we ask that you allow our experts to work towards achieving HR 6's aggressive goal without new guidelines by the burden of complying with individual state programs designed to meet the same end. Thank you very much, and I'll pass it over to my colleague, Steve.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Stephen Douglas with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and I want to thank you for
allowing me to say a few words. I am from California. I am from Sacramento, like Mr. Kaket. And for the past 13 years, I've been working on California vehicle regulations in California. So I have a fair amount of experience with the regulations, how they work, and how manufacturers react to them. You've been kind enough to let me say a few words, so I won't take up a lot of your time. And in fact, rather than going into a detailed discussion of the regulations, I thought it might be more productive if I simply addressed a few issues or items that seem to do nothing more than muddy the waters. And then if you have questions about the regulations, how manufacturers implement them, I'd be more than happy to answer your questions. As I said, there's a number of statements that tend to be do nothing more than muddy the waters. I wouldn't say the statements are false, but adopting California has no impact on the stated concern. So to me, they're just deliberately confusing. So I'll go through these. First, adopting California regulations will not have any impact on the health of Minnesota residents. The most sensitive air pollution monitors in the world couldn't tell you the difference between if you have a California standards or the federal standards. The difference between the two programs is just too small to detect. And I think we all want to improve health, reduce ozone, and reduce asthma rates, and we're headed in the right direction. Minnesota already meets all of the national clean air standards, and the regulations already in place federally will reduce pollution from vehicles another 60% between now and 2020. This is what that graph shows right there. The bottom three lines, the red and blue, are the federal program, and then I think the blue program is federal on the bottom, and the red is California. And you can see they're right together. That black line at the top is the old program. So there's simply just no difference between the two in terms of health. You can't detect it, and it won't have any impact on the health of Minnesota. It's ironic that the legislation would adopt regulations from the state with the worst air quality in the country. Ultimately, it's your decision whether you adopt or don't adopt California's standards. However, you should understand that adopting them is not going to reap some huge health benefit from Minnesota. The second, adopting California regulations will not have any impact on climate, the temperature, the moose population, or the number of maple trees in the state. You probably heard or read that we must adopt this legislation to protect the moose and maples. But ask them to show you one shred of evidence that suggests turning your regulations over to California will have any impact on the moose population or the number of maple trees. Ask them to show you any evidence that the temperature will change by any measurable amount if Minnesota turns over its vehicles to California. Ask them to show you any evidence that suggests that there will be any impact that could be felt by any human being or any animal or any plant on the planet if you turn your vehicles over to California. There is none. Not even California, with a much larger vehicle population and presumably a much larger impact on climate change, they never claimed their regulations would have any measurable impact on the climate. In fact, and I'll quote here from a statement that Sierra Club, NRDC, and Environmental Defense agreed to. Quote, they were defendants in the lawsuit. Defendants are not aware of any credible scientific evidence to support the theory that CO2 emission reductions resulting from the adoption of ARB regulations in all 50 states in the United States would change average ambient temperatures in any place by any measurable amount. That's Sierra Club, NRDC, and Environmental Defense. It's undisputed that adopting these regulations will have no impact on climate in Minnesota. Again, it's your decision to adopt them or not adopt them, but that decision isn't going to have any impact on the moose or the maples in Minnesota. However, that's not to say that reducing greenhouse gas or improving vehicle efficiency isn't important. It is, and the Alliance supported, as Ms. Dooley said, a comprehensive national program to address greenhouse gas emissions and vehicle efficiency. The Energy Independence Act is a national program. that reduces greenhouse gas emissions, improves vehicle efficiency, and reduces our dependence on foreign oil. It promotes, rather than discourages, the use of ethanol in flex-fuel vehicles. This brings me to my last point. California's program does discourage flex-fuel vehicles. This isn't fantasy, it's fact. Look at the ads for the Dodge flex-fuel vehicles. Not available in California. The Dodge flexible fuel vehicles aren't available in California. Look at the ads for the 2007 Ford F-150. Not available in California. Look at the ads for the 2007 Lincoln Town Car. Not available in California or any of the five California states that were mentioned. I live in California and I can't get these vehicles. But that's not new. In the past, ARB has prohibited technologies that were out of favor with decision makers. In 1998, ARB deliberately eliminated light-duty diesel vehicles. And it's been almost 10 years now, and we're finally seeing one or two light-duty diesel vehicles in California. In California, me as a resident, I couldn't purchase a diesel Jetta, even though it had far superior fuel economy and lower greenhouse gas emissions than the gas version. California specifically prohibited. Ethanol has certainly not been one of California's chosen fuels. In fact, as Mr. Kett said, there's only three public stations in California, in the whole state. So it's not surprising that the regulations, while not specifically prohibiting flex-fuel vehicles, certainly discourage their introduction. And here's how. First, exhaust emissions. In California, vehicles must certify to one of four categories. The bottom two of these are the super ultra-low vehicle emission standard, or the SULEV standard, and the zero emission vehicle standard. There's not a single flex-fuel vehicle on the planet that is ever certified to either one of these standards, not a single one. Moreover, ARB has never demonstrated that these standards could be met by flex-fuel vehicles. They tossed around a few ideas that manufacturers were already looking into, and are, but they never demonstrated it can be done. There are two higher standards, but manufacturers have to mix and match to ensure they meet an average. Each year, ARB reduces this average, and each year, more and more vehicles must meet the SULEV standard, again, that flex-fuel vehicles can't meet. The second element of ARB's regulations that affects flex-fuel vehicles is the ZED mandate. The ZED mandate is another area where flex-fuel vehicles are effectively locked out. The ZED mandate requires somewhere between 30% and 40% of the vehicles to meet a partial zero emission vehicle standard, or the PZEV. The PZEV standards include not only the SULEV exhaust, which manufacturers can't meet, but also the zero VAP standard. Again, not a single flex-fuel vehicle can meet either one of these. And I think I know what you're thinking is, we're not adopting the ZED mandate. Well, therein lies the problem. When you hitch your wagon to California, you're going to follow California's track. And just less than 2 weeks ago, California adopted changes to the ZED mandate, or the board directed staff to take the PZEV portion out of the ZED mandate and put it in the emissions regulations, which this legislation would adopt. So you would be covered by that. So even though you're not adopting the ZED mandate, you're going to get the partial zero-emission vehicle portion of that if ARB follows through on the board's direction. Finally, the greenhouse gas regulation. This hasn't been implemented in California or any other state. And you think, finally, the carrot, finally the incentive. You think that at least the greenhouse gas regulations in California would provide some incentives for flex-fuel vehicles. And in fact, the manufacturer can get some marginal credit for flex-fuel vehicles. However, only if they monitor the driving behavior of their customers, what type of fuel they use, how much they refill, and then they report that to the Air Resources Board. To me, it seems a little bit invasive to tell a customer, oh, and by the way, if you buy this flex-fuel vehicle, we have to track your vehicle, what type of fuel you use, how often you refill, and report that to the government. That's all for our benefit. Even if the manufacturer did that and the customer agreed, there are only three fueling stations in the whole state, so there's not going to be any credit. Why would manufacturers do that? In fact, if California were setting the standards for the nation, as they seem to want to do, it would surprise me if ethanol didn't die entirely. The death of ethanol would be fine for some California decision makers. So again, it's your choice. It's certainly yours. But you should make that decision with a clear understanding of the consequences. Again, I sincerely appreciate your time and attention, and I'd be more than glad to answer any questions now or later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Douglas. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Jim Ellman, manager of vehicle emissions with General Motors Public Policy Center. I am here today testifying on behalf of General Motors in opposition to HF 863, legislation that proposes to require adoption of the California Vehicle Emission Standards. GM supports the comments made by the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, of which we are a member. I'd just like to start by emphasizing that GM is developing and introducing a wide variety of advanced technologies to improve fuel efficiency, reduce emissions, and diversify our energy usage. These include our efforts toward electrification of the automobile. We have developed multiple hybrid systems for a variety of vehicle types, ranging from cars to SUVs and pickups to city buses. And we are developing the Chevy Volt extended range electric vehicle, an electric vehicle that will go about 40 miles on the battery charge alone, at which time a range extender turns on to maintain battery charge for trips greater than 40 miles. And we continue our aggressive development of hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. And importantly, we are developing these advanced technologies for introduction nationwide, not just in states that have California requirements. But we believe multiple approaches must be pursued to achieve our reduced emissions and energy diversification goals. And the approach that we believe has the greatest near-term potential is E85. Instead of gasoline, if a flex fuel vehicle is fueled with E85, with the ethanol being derived from corn, greenhouse gas emissions are reduced by about 20%. Refueling with E85 with the ethanol derived from cellulosic sources reduces greenhouse gas emissions by over 60%. To take advantage of these large reductions, GM is aggressively rolling out more and more E85 flex fuel vehicles. We now have over 3 million E85 FFVs on the road in the U.S., the industry leader. And we are producing about 400,000 FFVs annually, with a commitment to make a full one-half of our North American production flex fuel by 2012. But as we roll out more FFVs, we are running into barriers created by the California Emission Standards. The first barrier is California's SULEV tailpipe standard, which is part of both the LEV emissions program and the ZEV mandate PZEV requirements. And this SULEV standard presents unique technical challenges for E85 FFVs. Specifically, we have not achieved the SULEV NMOG tailpipe standard either at the normal test temperature of 75 degrees or the colder 50 degree requirement. The volatility differences between E85 and gasoline result in NMOG emissions on E85 that exceed these standards before the catalytic converter is warmed up. And I read California's response on this issue suggesting that direct injection and air injection could help. We've looked at both of those, both individually and in combination, and while they're directionally helpful, they don't come close to getting us down to the SULEV levels. Second, California's zero evaporative emission standard, which is part of the ZEV mandate's PZEV requirements, also presents unique technical challenges for E85 FFVs. While evaporative emissions on E85 are actually lower than on gasoline, California requires that the vehicles be tested on a worst-case blend, E10 or 10% ethanol. E10 has increased volatility and permeation compared to either gasoline or E85. As a result, our FFVs, which use plastic fuel tanks, have not achieved the zero evaporative emission requirement. California has suggested metal tanks could be used, but metal tanks have several drawbacks, including added weight that hurts fuel economy, they're more susceptible to corrosion, there's really an inadequate supply base right now, higher cost, and metal tanks do not have the flexibility for vehicle packaging, so they could only be implemented during major model redesign. Because we have not achieved compliance with either the California SULA tailpipe standard or the California zero evaporative emission requirements, we are currently restricting sales of E85 FFVs in all states that have California standards in place. And just to be clear, that includes states that have California standards without the ZEV mandate, as well as those that do have the ZEV mandate. In other words, vehicles that would have been E85 flex fuel vehicles are being displaced by gasoline vehicles that meet the SULAV and PZEV standards in these states. And as the SULAV and PZEV standards requirements ramp up going forward, the number of E85 flex fuel vehicles displaced will grow. Another point worth mentioning is that California's greenhouse gas regulations provide no practical credit for E85 because the regulations require that the manufacturer be able to prove that E85 is used by the operator. While GM can build and sell E85 flex fuel vehicles, because we are in the business of building and selling vehicles, we cannot structure a compliance plan around ensuring and tracking E85 usage. I would like to close by saying that California is in a different position than Minnesota. California does have the worst air quality in the country and has historically set the most stringent standards for smog-forming emissions. These standards have been established based on the capability of gasoline vehicles. As a result, there have been restrictions in technologies that did not meet these gasoline-based standards, namely diesels and E85 FFVs. We believe California will continue with this approach in the future, especially since California continues to be a long way from attainment to the air quality standards, and that task is frankly even more challenging with the new ozone standards recently passed. And importantly, Minnesota would be bound to any future standards that California adopts. In comparison, the federal government has been careful to adopt a more flexible structure for smog forming standards to accommodate technologies such as diesel and E85 that offer reduced greenhouse gas emissions and energy diversity. We believe the more balanced federal approach is the best for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 1981, I bought a brand new car that I put about 150,000 miles on it. By the time I sold it, I kept track of every gallon I bought, and I averaged over 45 miles per gallon from the time I bought it until the time I sold it. The same car manufacturer today, their best car gets 30 miles per gallon. Toyota makes a car that gets over 50 miles per gallon. Honda gets close to that. Why is it that the American car manufacturers have not kept up or have, I mean, we've got all this new technology since 1981, and yet we're going backwards. Is that because our government hasn't required you to do it, or because you haven't been able to make any money doing it? Why is that? Because, I mean, if we get, you know, 50 miles per gallon, our pollution problems, our foreign oil problems, I mean, we'd be in great shape. What's the best excuse you've got for not doing a better job of that?
Who wants that one?
I'll take a shot at it.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Phelps. First of all, I'm not sure what manufacturer has a vehicle that doesn't achieve more than 30 miles per gallon. There's over 100 models that achieve far more than 30 miles per gallon, and I'm not aware of any manufacturer, except perhaps Lamborghini or Ferrari, which have no vehicle which achieves high mileage. In fact, I think most of them have multiple vehicles that get that kind of, that get 30 plus, 35. I'm not sure. And I think as far as your, the 1981 vehicle that gets 41 miles per gallon, I think a lot of the regulations that have been adopted along the way to reduce pollution have discouraged the, you know, the fuel economy. It's a trade-off, and it always has been, you know, between fuel economy and the pollution equipment that manufacturers installed. And so the vehicles are much cleaner, and now the fuel economy is improving as well. So I suspect your 1981 was a diesel.
No, it was not. No, it was a gas, and it went like a, well, it went fast. And so, I mean, it wasn't a wimpy little, I mean, it was a small car, but I just bought a new vehicle, and I've never bought a foreign-made vehicle. Everything's been American-made, which is, you know, I'm proud of that. But I did shopping, and I went to car dealers, and one car manufacturer, the best they had was 30 miles per gallon, it was an American company, and they only had one vehicle that I'm aware of that even got that good. I mean, others do have multiples that get over 35, over 30, between 30 and 35, but I don't think any of them have 40 or more.
Well, first, we appreciate you buying a new car. Second of all, I'd encourage you to go to, I believe it's fueleconomy.gov. It lists all the vehicles by fuel economy. I can assure you that every manufacturer offers multiple vehicles that get high fuel economy. And 1981 vehicles polluted it probably. One 1980 vehicle probably pollutes more than 50 new vehicles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last rebuttal is that, I mean, I'd buy that if nobody was getting 45 and 50 miles per gallon today. But people are doing it. There's cars out there that are doing it. And so, you know, if they can do it in Japan, why can't we do it here?
Is that a rhetorical question?
I think so. Representative Peterson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. For the history for the committee and some of the testifying that's going on about too far, too fast, I'd like to remind people that in CAFE standards that Mr. Clinton and Mr. Gore for 8 years never even proposed it. And that was confirmed to me by Secretary of Interior Babbitt on a side conversation. So our own Green Democrats and Mr. Gore, they didn't even bother in the 90s. And you could ask about why that was. I think a lot of it had to do with Mr. Dingell and unions. So no, nobody's exactly innocent here with this too far, too fast. And, you know, I'm a proponent of anybody who's been around of picking a percent and picking a year, 25% by 2025. I really hope it happens. And in the history of ethanol, you could say that that's part of the family as well, 10%, ED10, that amendment on the floor that has my dad's name on it. So, you know, very familiar with this type of conversation. And Representative Junkie, I sure hope you and Mr. Magnus can get 25% by 2025 biofuels as a standard sooner than later, not just a goal. You can put your name on the list and all of that good stuff. So you hear about this too far, too fast, and I wonder, you know, just what was your industry's opinion in the early 90s of E10? And ethanol in general, now E20, and advocacy for, sounds like E85, but not just this way in California, this method. And could you just go back with the history of your original position on E10, you know, prior 1992, 3, 4, right down in there? And I got a couple follow-ups.
And I would concur with Representative Peterson. We do appreciate you coming full circle on ethanol, because there was a time where you were sitting up there in front of this committee against the E10 and the E20 mandate, which I sat through also and was on the conference committee. So we do appreciate your advocacy for flex fuel on E85 right now, but maybe you can answer how you've come to this epiphany.
I wasn't around in 1992. I think I was on a submarine somewhere.
I as well can't speak to 1992 before my time with Amtrak. I know our position today is essentially an E-10 mandate for fuel. All vehicles on the road today can sustain and work with the E-10 mandate. Anything higher than E-10 between E85 or any E85 included requires the use of flex-fuel vehicles in order to conform to our system. And many of our manufacturers have stated a significant interest in getting there. In addition to GM, Ford, and Chrysler have both committed to producing 50% of their fleet to be flex-fuel vehicles by 2012.
And for me, and then that HR6, you know, we had the Senate vote for the CAFE standard increase in the U.S. Senate. You know, that got like 88 votes. So that kind of tells me, you know, I don't know if it's going to happen. Hopefully it happens. I mean, our energy standard got 100 and some votes. I really hope it happens. But those lopsided votes kind of say, you know, we'll leave it to the regulators and hope it goes. But really, maybe I'm just wondering about these... You know, I wonder why should we trust you on E85 now, given that the chair of the committee answered the question about your past history on ethanol support back in the day before a lot of us were here, but you remember it. So, you know, why should we trust you now to be this ethanol advocate that when your track record in the past for E10, E20, or just E10, has not been stellar and nor very supportive? And I guess if I could just take it one step further. Why do I see gas friendly to gas free billboards and such? And it seems like, I mean, if these people don't want these cars, why are you guys for the gas friendly to gas free? I mean, what? And you list everything up on there, and I've just. Reaching for some answers here. I mean, you can. That's good to hire a smart PR firm. Anybody can do it. But I don't think you've been very, very, very consistent in your message on ethanol. So why should we believe you now?
Okay, gas friendly to gas free is
Elmer.
Thank you. Gas friendly to gas free is from Chevrolet.
Yes. 1 second. It doesn't matter to me who it's from. You guys all go to the same conferences. You all go to the same happy hours. You all hang out. All have the same PR firms. Don't even bother.
It's kind of like rural members. We all hang out at the same bar, too.
We are trying to generate interest in these new advanced technologies that we're working on. We've got... more engineers than we've ever had before working on all of these different technologies, E85 to hybrid to the Chevy Bolt to hydrogen fuel cells. And as we start introducing more and more of these products going forward, we need to have consumer education and interest. And initially, the cost on these new technologies will be high, and we need time to generate or develop subsequent generations of designs to bring the cost down over time. But part of it, too, is just getting the consumers interested in these new technologies, and we're trying very hard to do that.
Okay. See no further questions. Oh, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chairs, and just a follow-up on HR6. HR6 relates to a lot of issues. CAFE standards are probably the most common one. How many years had it been before HR6 was passed since there had been changes legislatively to the CAFE standards?
Chair, Representative Hanson, I'm not familiar with the legislative history. Again, I haven't been here that long. I know it's been as Representative Peterson said, the Clinton administration knows that year there wasn't any change. I'm not familiar before that.
All right. Representative Hansen?
Was it around 20 years, maybe, since the CAFE standard has been changed legislatively?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman, maybe you know.
I do. I worked in Washington, D.C. as a legislative correspondent for Senator John Kerry, 1991 to 1992, and I wrote letters to constituents in Massachusetts. Dear constituents, Senator Kerry supports a change in the CAFE standard. That standard did not change from the time I worked in Washington, D.C. in 1991, and that bill had been pending for many years before I was writing letters to constituents in Massachusetts about it. So it was longer than 1991.
Roughly 20 years. Representative Hansen.
And then maybe in the shorter time period, since the bill was signed, I think, in December, early December, do the auto manufacturers have any legislative proposals on maybe tweaking HR 6, or you found something that was, you know, that overlooked when it was passed, or where you might need some changes to just make it work better? Are there any proposed amendments or bills introduced that you're looking at for changing HR 6?
Ms. Dooley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, the automobile industry played a significant role in getting HR 6 passed. We worked with several folks in the Congress to come to an agreement on this standard. And while throughout the process, all of 2007, there were various legislative proposals introduced, the final conclusion of HR 6 was something the Alliance supported and was actually mentioned in support of on the House floor by Speaker Pelosi. As far as legislative amendments moving forward, none to my knowledge are sponsored by the Alliance.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Junkie. And I believe it was mentioned by Ms. Dooley that somebody was going to answer the question about how does this bill decrease the incentive for flex fuel vehicles. And throughout all the conversation, the different testimonies, I think I heard bits and pieces, but could someone please recap and clarify for me how does this bill decrease the incentive for auto manufacturers to make flex fuel vehicles?
Dr. Douglas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. I'll try to summarize and ask any questions. There's effectively three elements of California's program. There's an emissions part, a zero-emission vehicle mandate part, and there's a greenhouse gas part. For the emission part, one of those standards, one of the four is SULAV and the others, and no flex fuel vehicles ever met that. There's also the zero-emission, the zero-advance standard that no flex fuel vehicle has ever met. Between those two, and again, I recognize you're not adopting the ZEV mandate, but ARB intends to modify the ZEV mandate to put part of it in the emissions portion that you are adopting. So that accounts for about 40% of the vehicles, flex fuel, 40% of the vehicle fleet, a flex fuel vehicle can't meet. As far as, is there any incentive for a manufacturer to produce and sell a flex fuel vehicle in California under their rules? No. Because, one, you have to track how consumers behave and report that to the government, and that's probably going to be a little invasive. And, two, there's only three stations there, so it's not like you'd get much credit even if you were to track all your consumers and report that to the government. So that's kind of a combination of a disincentive on the first two elements and no incentive on the greenhouse gas element. That's in pretty stark contrast with HR 6, where they give incentives for producing flex fuel vehicles, and they have mandates to for biofuel production use.
All right, thank you. We're going to move on. Oh, wait a minute. Representative Tremba.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. At one point you said that some of the reasons that these vehicles weren't being used or wanted, because you said something like getting used to technology. Well, the kids I know are pretty new and know about technology. My daughter knows exactly what car she's going to buy when she gets out of college, and it's not an American made, which makes me sad. But it's the best she can get with her mileage and the safety pieces. I have gotten calls from people that are 80-some years old down to kids getting ready to get a driver's license. I have my car has 170,000 miles on it because I can't find a car that fits my needs when it comes to mileage and safety. So, I don't know. The technology thing, I think these kids and a lot of people understand and are now going for to are buying cars that are made outside of the United States.
All right. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on. Thank you very much for coming and fielding all sorts of different questions. I don't know if Alyssa Schlander still wants to. Yep, here she comes. And company. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Solander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Members of the committee, we represent the retailers. We are the Minnesota businesses here who are caught in the middle of this fight between the automakers and the environmentalists who want you to force the automakers to change their products. We are in a unique position here with this issue, most of all because we are franchisees. And because we're franchisees, we are dependent on one source to get our product. Our inventory only comes from the automakers. If you are a Ford dealer, you can only get Ford F-150s from Ford Motor Company. And if Ford Motor Company is telling you that they cannot give you Ford F-150s because they cannot meet the California standards, you have no other option. You can't go get Ford F-150s from some other corporation. That's it. So we have to believe the manufacturers when they are telling us this legislation will cause them to restrict supply, restrict inventory from our dealership. As it was already explained by several other people before me, we know that there are certain pickups, SUVs, minivans that already meet the California standards, and we are happy about that. But the rub comes from how these standards are administered, that they are a fleet-wide average standard, which means that the manufacturers, in order to stay compliant with the standards and the percentages of vehicles that have to fit into certain categories in the standards, that means that they'll have to restrict supply, which means that we have to restrict the demands of our customers. And if we can't meet our customers' demands, that is a very serious issue to our Minnesota businesses. You know, frankly, I think most of our dealers would say if a customer is going to be spending $20,000 to $40,000 on a vehicle purchase, they ought to be getting exactly what they want. As was explained before, there are no flex fuel vehicles that can meet the super ultra low emission standard. And that means that there are vehicle manufacturers that will just restrict sales of those vehicles. You know, proponents of this bill have accused us of lying, of using scare tactics to tell you that we're going to restrict vehicles. But the facts are clear. When you look at the sales statistics in California states, you cannot deny the fact that flex fuel vehicles suffer. It was stated before that flex fuel vehicles do very well in California states. And I want to just direct your attention to this chart, which is also in your packet. It looks exactly like that. It says flex fuel vehicle sales on the top of it. Every one of those states that's highlighted in pink on that chart are California vehicle emission states. And you can see that those states have the lowest percentages of flex fuel vehicle sales in those states. Now, New Mexico and Maryland, who are at the top and highlighted in yellow, those are two states that have passed California's standards, but they have not yet gone into effect. So we just wanted to be clear that those states passed it, but they haven't seen any effect because the law has not become effective in those states. Minnesota is at the top of this list when it comes to selling flex fuel vehicles. We'd like to keep it that way. We'd like to keep Minnesota moving up that list, because we have a state that's committed to promoting ethanol, and we've got dealers who are happy when farmers are buying trucks. So we really sincerely want to see more flex fuel vehicle sales, not less. And I think this chart is illustrative of the fact that flex fuel vehicles do not do well in California states. As was also mentioned before, I just want to remind you, there are plenty of flex fuel models that are simply not available in California states. I think it was mentioned the Jeep Grand Cherokee, the Jeep Commander, the Chrysler Aspen, Dodge Durango, Dodge Ram, Dodge Dakota. For customers who are looking for a car with a flex fuel motor, which there are fewer cars available with a flex fuel motor. Most flex fuel vehicles are optioned in the SUVs, trucks, bigger vehicles. But, you know, many customers would like a car, as Representative Morrow drives a Taurus flex fuel vehicle. California does not allow a Lincoln Town Car with a flex fuel. The manufacturers do not offer the Lincoln Town Car with a flex fuel motor or Chrysler Sebring with a flex fuel motor. And in addition, Chevrolet has, you know, quite a selection of flex fuel motors, but they do restrict sales of flex fuel motors in California states because there is just simply no incentive to sell flex fuel motors in under this regulatory scheme. I'll just also mention, in addition to the problems that this legislation creates for getting supply from the manufacturers, it also creates difficulties for dealers and Minnesota customers in sharing supply with other sources. I think Representative Magnus mentioned earlier about buying vehicles outside of Minnesota. And of course, we would prefer customers to buy vehicles from Minnesota dealers. But the fact is, if you come into a dealership, for instance, and you want, if you want a red Dodge Durango, and your dealership only has blue Dodge Durangos, well, your dealer will be able to find you the red Durango that you want, even if that dealer has to dealer trade. They trade a blue Durango for the red one you want with a dealer outside the state. They own North Dakota, South Dakota. I have talked to a dealer who went all the way to Chicago. This happens every day in Minnesota, where dealers are trying to find Minnesota customers the vehicles that they want with the options they want, and they'll do it by trading what's on their lot for what the customer wants, which is on another lot. And that helps us keep those sales inside Minnesota. Well, under this legislation, we would not be able to do that all the time. There are some manufacturers that do manufacture vehicles that are able to be titled in all 50 states, but there are many that do not. And if you buy a vehicle, whether it's through a dealer or you buy it on your own outside of Minnesota, if it is not a California certified vehicle, it would not be able to be legally titled here in Minnesota. California has an entire brochure trying to educate their citizens about when they can bring vehicles in from another state and when they may not, and more likely than not, they may not. So, Mr. Chair, I know this is we've kind of gone long on time here today, so I'll try to wrap up and just end by saying that this bill will mean real costs for Minnesotans. In exchange, we get very, very little benefit, and we would encourage you to please reject the California Vehicle Emissions Standards Bill. Thank you.
Mr. Lambert?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Scott Lambert. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief. I was not intending testify today. Mitch Lander can do an excellent job stating our position and has done so until I read the paper this morning. And in case you haven't had a chance to read the newspaper, you'll see a column by Representative Portman and Senator Marty attacking me personally and accusing me of misleading and lying to the legislature and the public. During the course of this debate, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, we've been very careful not to accuse the opposition of lying. I think we have a genuine disagreement on this issue, and we have a big disagreement on the effects of this bill. But I want you to know that I'm very comfortable with anything I've written or anything I've said. It's unfortunate that Representative Portman would have to take on what was a robust public debate and turn it into a personal attack. But Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, after 20 years of presenting arguments to the legislature, I don't feel a need to defend my integrity to her or Senator Marty. What I would like to do is just make a couple comments on the bill, and then stand with Mitch Lander for questions. And if anyone feels misled by me, I'd be more than willing to engage in those questions. Mr. Chairman, the bill is the start of an attempt by the environmental movement to take Minnesotans out of their trucks. I sat on the governor's climate change advisory group for over 8 months. I heard these proposals. A lot of them were vetted out. A lot fell on the floor. A lot are still in the report. And this is just the start of that attempt. It will clearly limit the availability of vehicles that Minnesotans can buy the most. As we've seen, the bill will have an adverse impact on ethanol. A lot has already been said on that. And I think that will bring great damage to the state's economy. And finally, I think the real purpose of this legislation is to move control of this issue to California, where environmental groups exert extraordinary control and influence and take it out of the hands of Minnesotans. Mr. Chairman, that's all I wanted to say today. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, and to the witness. You've been writing many op-eds and going around yourself, I believe I've read here the California, and this is what you've said in an op-ed recently, is that the California Air Resources Board embodies everything extremists in the environmental movement want. So just that, and I have a follow-up. Do you think that's helpful language to refer to people as the extremists?
Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I don't think it's misleading.
Mr. Chair, it's misleading and very offensive to me. Certainly is. You know, you're trying to say the environmental movement is trying to take trucks out of Minnesota. But here I got this ad, gas friendly to gas free, which I'd buy at an auto dealership, when maybe I could, and it looks like there's some clearance on this hybrid, this Tahoe, part of California, close to Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, where the environmental extremists over 20 years, got the wolf off the endangered species list, so maybe I could shoot a wolf, because you can hunt them now on high-end reserves, from the seat of my environmental extremist hybrid. So, sir, I think you should maybe tone it down a little bit in your own op-eds, and realize that Representative Portman has done a lot of work on this bill today, members, and she has answered a lot of questions very well. And I'd just like, for the rest of the people who are going to come up here after you're done, is that how then do you explain if California has a $24 billion agricultural sector a year, that's 68% of our biennial budget, how would California, with the biggest ag economy in the nation, what was the history out there with the ag economy with California adopting the clean cars? The biggest ag state in the whole country. What do you explain the genesis of, you know, you've been to California, right? You've seen the corn in the Central Valley? You've seen it? Shouldn't be there, but it's there. Just some comments. And just, you know, but referring to people as extremists, sir, does not help your case in this building.
All right. Well, thank you, and thanks for coming up. Obviously, this is an intense debate, and hopefully we can keep it to a debate on the issues and on all sides, frankly. That's how we hope to move forward here on the Ag Committee side, anyway. We're a friendly committee, have you noticed? All right.
Mr. Fish,
thank you.
So friendly, you haven't fined anybody, even though there's been violators.
I have not heard. You're free to turn them in, Representative Portman. Point them out. I have not heard them. Mr. Lampert, not Lambert, Lampert from National Ethanol Coalition. Then we have Bruce Jones and Steve Kramer after that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Lampert. I serve as the Executive Director of the National Ethanol Vehicle Coalition. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I was here in 1992 when we started to talk about flexible fuel vehicles and when Minnesota became a leader in the establishment of flexible fuel vehicles. And I think that's something that we've missed a little bit today. Mr. Tekep is suggesting that Minnesota consider the leadership of California in this low carbon fuel, greenhouse gas issues, zero emission vehicle issues. Minnesota has frankly been the leader in ethanol. When Minnesota was doing E85 and E10 programs, California was working on methanol programs. And to talk about the number of flexible fuel vehicles in California, it's a little over 1% of the total population of vehicles. Here in Minnesota, it's 3.77%. We've heard numbers of two E85 stations in California, three or four. I'll tell you as a fact today, there are five. There are 344 in Minnesota. That's a significant difference. I've heard the comments in regard to we may have E10 in the future. They do not have E10 today. They do not have a massive E85 program. If you look at some of the literature of late, the San Jose Mercury News, 33108, 4 years ago this month, Governor Schwarzenegger signed an executive order to create a hydrogen highway. Hundreds of hydrogen fueling stations will be built. In February, the state legislature, a nonpartisan or state legislative analyst office, recommended the legislature not fund the program because the administration has little visible progress to show. That's my concern here. I think Representative Portman is exactly right, that this is a type of project that should be no regrets. But at the same time, you've got two other complementary laws that go with it, and that's the laws of no good deed should go unpunished. And I'm concerned with the issue of how Minnesota and your tremendous public leadership on flexible fuel vehicles and ethanol would be punished with the adoption of such a program. And also the law of unintended consequences. It is certainly prudent for any intelligent society to take low-cost, no-cost issues and respond to greenhouse gas emissions, and we should be doing that. It's our position and that of the National Ethanol Vehicle Coalition that this is not a low-cost, no-cost provision. In the issue of full disclosure, I want to say that General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Nissan sit on my board of directors, as does the Minnesota corn growers, the Kansas corn growers, the Ohio corn growers, the National corn growers, other commodity organizations. We want to support clean air. We want to support greenhouse gas emission reductions. I have worked with the California Air Resources Board for many, many years. And if we had a retailer that wanted to put in the sixth E85 station today, you could not do it because the bureaucracy stacks on top of the bureaucracy. And we have issues regarding stage two vapor recovery. You don't know, you've never heard of stage two vapor recovery in Minnesota. You shouldn't have it because all our vehicles have onboard vapor recovery, which both CARB and EPA says is more effective than stage two vapor recovery. The CARB still requires stage two vapor recovery. I don't think that you want that in Minnesota today. So I would simply suggest that we take the prudence measure as we go forward in some of these issues. I want to thank you for spending so much of your afternoon being here today. I'm available at your convenience, Representative, to assist you with adopting a low-cost, no-cost mechanism to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But this is a program based on maize and predicates, and we might and we maybes. And you are far past that with ethanol today, with 670 million gallons, with 17 plants underway. There's two plants in California. You have, again, 344 stations. I think that it may be appropriate for us to send state employees to California and not to encourage piece of legislation, but just simply to testify on it, because certainly that's in my 25 years of government. I think that's what happened today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lampert. I think we're good. That was very good. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bruce Jones.
Is he here? I don't see him. Steve Kramer. Followed by Randy Doyle and then Kevin Papp.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, and members of the committees. My name is Steve Kramer. I'm a farmer from Hector in Renville County and currently serve on the board of directors of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Now, the hour is late. Everything I have in my testimony has been said about twice. And in the interest of time, I just want to make a couple points. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Portman for interlegislation taking into account the position of ethanol and E85 in the economy of Minnesota and in the way that it affects our environment here in Minnesota. We continue to raise questions as a precaution against good intentions leading to unintended consequences. We see no benefit in rushing to adopt another state's standards, and our own methods for addressing air quality are proven to be effective. Therefore, the Minnesota Corn Growers opposes adopting the California Clean Air Standards for three main reasons. These are ambiguous rules that are ever-changing. They have the potential to impede the progress Minnesota has already made with our successful E85 model, and they do not address the needs of our state. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Randy Doyle. Followed by Kevin Papp, Doug Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Randall Doyle. I am General Manager of Alcorn Clean Fuel down in Claremont. Our facility's been operating now for 12 years, which makes us one of the older facilities here in Minnesota. But my gray hair was earned in the industry. I've been in the industry for over 25 years. And that's really what I wanted to testify to today. There are things that California and Minnesota have in common, and things that we should probably follow California's lead on. If we develop oceanfront properties, we should look to California for surfers. I think they probably lead the nation in that. But not necessarily in terms of fuel legislation. In 1985, there was a study from University of Maine that talked about the effects of MTB of groundwater. In 1988, California passed its legislation that basically mandated MTB as gasoline. At the same time, states like Minnesota and New Mexico were looking at other means, primarily ethanol, and we followed that here in Minnesota with a very strong ethanol industry. We've watched as MTB was proved, as we already knew, to be a bad actor in groundwater, and have chosen now instead to use ethanol rather than MTBE. I would say in that regard, Minnesota was far ahead. I would like to see Minnesota stay in the lead, and I would urge caution and diligence as we pursue any legislation, particularly one that would tie us to California's lead as it relates to fuel.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Papp, followed by Mr. Peterson and Mr. Hostlund. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Junkie, Chairwoman Lutremba, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Papp. My wife, Julie, and I own and operate a fourth-generation family farm in Blue Earth County, where we raise corn, soybeans, and boys. I'm president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, a general farm organization comprised of 78 local Farm Bureau associations with nearly 30,000 members. In agriculture, there are two words that affect most everything we do. Certainties and uncertainties. Farmers need certainties to operate. We need certainty with federal farm programs, certainty with local, state, and national regulations, certainty with having enough seed to plant our crops in a few weeks, feed our animals, certainty that we'll have a transportation infrastructure to get our products to consumers, and certainty that we'll have a market to sell our products to. We also have a lot of uncertainty. Uncertainty in our markets, uncertainty in the availability of fuel, seed, fertilizer, and above all, uncertainty with Mother Nature. Those same two words, certainty and uncertainty, apply when we look at the legislation before us. Those who support this legislation have made it very clear that they believe this legislation will be beneficial to Minnesota's ethanol industry. Those that oppose this legislation have also made it very clear that they believe this legislation will be detrimental or even the end to our ethanol industry. There seems to be much uncertainty, maybe too much uncertainty. There are many people throughout this state, many who are in this room today, who have worked long and hard to get our E85 infrastructure where it is today. We need the certainty that the E85 infrastructure will not only survive, but will have the opportunity to thrive in our state. As you've heard today, there's a lot of concern, a lot of uncertainty that adopting California emission standards will hurt our ethanol industry, and particularly our E85 infrastructure. In order for manufacturers to get credit for the sale of flex fuel vehicles, they have to provide proof that E85 vehicle is using E85 fuel. Proponents have said that this can be accomplished through a survey, or more effectively, through the use of onboard technology. However, it has been noted that a number of factors connected to the collection of the data through onboard diagnostics, which could provide disincentives for manufacturers to sell flex fuel vehicles, including the cost of the onboard diagnostics, a cost which will be passed on to consumers, the availability of technology to collect the data needed, possible privacy issues, and the time lapse in reporting. Any disincentive for manufacturers to sell flex fuel vehicles leaves us with an uncertainty as to whether or not they will continue to sell those vehicles. If Minnesota auto dealers quit selling flex fuel vehicles, our E85 infrastructure will crumble beneath itself. There is uncertainty with the implementation of the super ultra-low emission vehicle standard because today flex fuel vehicles are not certified under the standard. The proponents have noted that by the time these standards are fully implemented, flex fuel vehicle technology will have advanced and those vehicles will be certified. But can they guarantee that with certainty? If not, we are left again with a high level of uncertainty whether or not our ethanol industry will be negatively affected by this standard. It's been clearly established today by adopting those California standards, Minnesota will be tying ourselves to any change the California Air Resources Board makes to their emission standards. By tying Minnesota to California, we are giving them the power to make decisions for us that could negatively impact our E85 infrastructure. There seems to be too many uncertainties today. I want to be perfectly clear, Minnesota Farm Bureau's opposition to this bill at this time does not mean Minnesota farmers are against clear air. Farmers have a vital stake and are committed to respecting and protecting our natural resources, both for ourselves and for future generations, while remaining a leader in providing food, fiber, and fuel. Farmers are business owners. Like any business owner, when we're faced with making major decisions that affect our farms, we will do everything we can to make sure there is as much certainty as possible that those decisions we make will have a positive outcome for our farms and our families. With the level of uncertainty the California standards could have on our ethanol industry, I urge you to bring this bill before your committee and take a further look at it, as we can say with certainty that this legislation will be a positive step for Minnesota and particularly our ethanol industry. I want to thank Representative Hartman for being open with the Minnesota Farm Bureau, sitting down with us and discussing these uncertainties. I want to thank the committee members, the chairs and the committee members for your time for this very important topic. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Papp. Appreciate it. Doug Peterson. Welcome, Representative Peterson. You never lose that title.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Junkie, and Representative Otremba, co-chair. Maybe a little brevity and levity should be placed within the legislative process today.
Lean a joke or what?
No, I haven't got that. But when I heard, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chairman, that the fact that Ford had a car that didn't quite make 85 miles per gallon, they only made 70, I wanted to get one. And then my first thought was, why has some of that industry not allowed for us to have those economies? And that bothers me a little bit. However, we're here today. My name is Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm here to voice some concerns about the House File 863. Very simply, our concerns boil down for our Farmers Union members, the policy promotes the production and use of ethanol in Minnesota.
Our members have heard concerns regarding the use of truck usage, sales, and adopting other state standards. And I want to stop right there. The question of E85 pumps. The number in Minnesota well outnumbers any in the whole country. Three or six in California. Ethanol use in E85, you're not going to buy a flex fuel vehicle if you don't have any place to get the fuel, are you? I just kind of wanted to throw that out there just for a little common sense. If you can't find the fuel, why are you going to buy a vehicle? So having said that, I would suggest very strongly that within this bill, and I'm sure this bill is a work in progress, that there be within this legislature increased E85 usage and increased pumps, and then also to the fuel companies that have denied E85 pumps in their aisles, that they bring forward methods or incentives to put E85 in. The major concern on this legislation, it does and may impact the use of ethanol. And the questions are huge. The questions are huge on use. Our policy says clean air. Our policy also says increased use. And I want to be very clear about this piece. We have met with Representative Horton this morning and appreciate her willingness and also the committee's willingness to listen to all of the testimony. But our comfort level would greatly increase if there was an annual report on the use of ethanol coming from California, and that would make this bill much more appealing to our farmers on policy. And we are very willing to reevaluate our position when this bill goes to the floor if we can feel more comfortable about the ethanol question and its use and increased use in the state of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chairman, and Madam Chair, I will stand for questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Magnin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point. I'm not sure the bill is going to the floor. I think the bill was tossed into the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill, and I'm not sure just what the process is with the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's dead in the Senate. I think they knocked it in the head.
Actually, the actual bill is sitting in finance, full finance committee right now, and I don't think it's in the omnibus bill, is it? No, it is not. It's an FYI. And we're a division of the finance committee, so we're still contemplating whether it gets down here or not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hortman.
Members, I just wanted to let Representative Peterson and the committee know I do have an amendment drafted to put the language in that Representative Peterson suggested would be helpful, and I'm hoping to work with you, Mr. Chair, and others in the agriculture community to make sure that we have all the pieces that we can in the bill that would make people feel more comfortable.
Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, just one final parting comment, not a parting comment. I'm glad you're there, okay, to make those decisions, because it's going to be a tough call. I think what you've got here in the state of Minnesota is a good industry. I think we've got a good environment for it. I think everybody wants to do the right thing, and that is to get away from the Mideast oil and have renewables. And how we get there, I think, has to be kind of balanced. And also, I'll say very much, very, very frankly, this issue will not improve if we are at each other's throats. Thank you.
Thank you. Former Representative Peterson understands how to move a bill through it. He was the author of the E10 legislation, members. Words of wisdom. Minnesota Truckers, followed by another representative who's in the room.
Mr. Sharon, and I didn't know if Mr. Hausbaden knew, but this bill does not apply to commercial trucks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. I'm John Hausladen, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. Good evening.
had to scratch out afternoon. I'm sure you're all feeling the same way. The trucking industry is committed to preserving our environment and reducing carbon emissions. We do that every day through a variety of mechanisms. We commit it, we demonstrate that through running new engines that emit one-tenth, I want to stress that, one-tenth the particulates that they did just a few years ago. We do that by burning new ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. We do it by adding auxiliary power units to our trucks or voluntarily reducing our driving speed to 65 miles per hour. But many of these changes have come with increased costs, as you can imagine. Those new engines, they sell for $10,000 more than they did just 1 year ago when they were introduced, or I should say from the old model year. The new ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel formulation is estimated to cost 4 to 5 cents more per gallon to produce, and auxiliary power units with a $7,000 to $10,000 price tag, while smart over the long run, really don't cash flow well when you have $4 diesel fuel. And at the outset, it is important to clarify, as Representative Portman said, that House File 863 does not currently address heavy commercial vehicles, only passenger vehicles. And to that end, that bill does not have a direct impact on our industry. However, we're here today because the chairman invited us to comment and give some of our unique experience that I think you'll find different from some of the testimony you've heard. While many in the hearing room here can only speculate what life would be like living under California-developed regulations, we can tell you firsthand what they're like. Our members pick up and deliver freight each and every day in California, and thus are subject to the regulations developed by the California Air Resources Board. And with apologies to our guests in California, the story is really not very pretty. So the point of our testimony is very simple. Life in the world controlled by CARB regulations is extremely challenging and extremely costly. There are at least 10 major CARB regulations that directly impact trucking. And while these regulations may have merit in California's unique geography, weather patterns, and their density, they don't work very well in Minnesota's very different environment. So here are just three examples for you to consider. Under CARB, truck engines must shut off automatically after 5 minutes of running time. Now that might work year-round in sunny San Diego, but not in the Red River Valley during the sugar beet harvest in late fall when the temperature drops below freezing. And just to show you how enforcement is handled, you can go on the CARB website today and get an idling commercial vehicle complaint form. And any citizen can take the form, complete it with the vehicle type, license plate number, vehicle name and number, date, time, location of incident, approximate year, make and model, send it into the state, and CARB folks will pay you a visit if that happens to be your truck. That's the kind of enforcement that we would have to deal with. Under CARB, by January 1st, 2010, all trucks older than model year 1994 will be banned from certain ports. Now that might make sense for the crowded port of Long Beach, but not the grain haulers delivering to Port Bungie and Savage. And under CARB, any big truck may be inspected for excessive smoke, immediately fined $300, and face an additional $500 fine if repair is not made within 45 days. Again, in heavily congested Los Angeles, that might be proper, but not for an older model truck pulling a fully loaded trailer out of a field in Lyon County. Now, with more than 75% of the state's manufactured freight hauled by truck and 68% of the state's communities served exclusively by truck, any environmental regulations impacting the trucking industry will impact agriculture. Mr. Chairman, we do share the author's desire to preserve Minnesota's environment, and we've worked with her on a number of issues. However, at least from our practical experience, we don't believe that putting the current and future vehicle regulations in the hands of the California Air Resources Board is the best approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? All right. Thanks for your time. Mr. Workman, and then we have one more. Brad Nelson that's signed up after him. Again, you never lose your title. Representative Workman, former chairman of the Transportation Committee. So he certainly knows about vehicles with wheels, which this is going to address. And I would also mention that I know you're aware of it, but back in January of 07, when this committee established its rules, we did invoke your name prominently. As the only committee I ever served under with a committee without rules was Representative Workman's until
The Ag Finance Committee, we are a committee without rules, following after your astute example.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Madam Chairman. Good to be back again, representing ABATE of Minnesota and the Motorcyclists of Minnesota. Former Representative Peterson is neither brief nor funny, but I'm going to give it a shot. We also, Mr. Chairman, are not, and members are not apparently in this bill, although CARB out there in California does, as you can see from my handout, they do include motorcycles. There's one thing your local motorcyclists don't want you to pass, and that's the California law that we can go between traffic in lanes. But it is a very, very real situation these regulations have done, and EPA regulations have already done a lot to the private shops and owners of motorcycles to be able to modify their motorcycles, what size tire they can put on, the pipes they can put on, the air cleaners, any kind of modification that you want to make. And again, Mr. Chairman, this is a time spent ahead of time, because I guess, in fact, we're not in, although we do see the nose and two humps under the tent with this bill. We are letting the committee know and the legislature know this affects us very heavily. I have the biggest Harley-Davidson you can buy, a 2003 Electric Glide Ultra Classic, 850 pounds of pure love, and I get 45 miles to the gallon right now. I'm not sure how much more we can get out of that, but Mr. Chairman, we know what this does. I think we're going to all be riding the same looking bike like the Chinese someday soon if we're not able to get that difference out of our motorcycles. Some of them want to go a little faster. I do not. Some want to make them a little louder. None of those things are possible under where these regulations end up taking us. And so, Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to belabor anything. We do oppose the legislation and look forward to riding free.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions, members, for former Representative Workman? Commissioner Workman, right? One more on my list, Brad Nelson, Minnesota Ethanol Producers, is here. If there's anyone we missed or that wants to testify, give a note to the page and they can bring it up. Otherwise, we're almost done, members. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
My name is Brad Nelson. I'm a third-generation farmer in Freeborn County. I have served on the Biorefining Glenville East Board since its inception, have been involved in the ethanol industry since the early 90s, and I would like to thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chairman, and the committee for the opportunity to testify. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Portman for taking the time to talk to our group last Friday. We all very much appreciate her passion and desire to have quality air to breathe. And I don't know that I can offer a lot of any more information than what you've heard today, but I hope I can offer a little bit of perspective and some of my past experience. And I feel that our state has led the nation in clean air since ethanol began to be blended into our fuel supply back in the early 90s. And our state decided to blend almost all gasoline sold in the state. It was for two reasons. Clean air and rural economic development. Both goals were achieved. Our state continues to lead with the largest number of E85 fueling stations and a push to 20% blend in the near future. I feel California has been behind us in the move to clean air. Only recently was MTBE taken out of the fuel mix, and today they are only blending 5.7%. Hopefully they will get to that 10% number soon. My understanding is, as we've all heard today, is that there are only three E85 fueling stations today in California. Testing vehicle emissions with fuel that is not used in Minnesota today, or what our state's future holds, creates a standard that doesn't apply here. I have had a difficult time separating motor vehicle emissions testing that are separate from the type of fuel used. We have a difficult time supporting the bill that creates uncertainty for the ethanol market. We feel that all vehicles manufactured should be flex fuel. That's one thing we would certainly like to see. And once again, it would achieve two goals: create cleaner air and water, and continue to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Today, Minnesota has saved 1 year's worth of gasoline since the Minnesota mandate began 10 years ago. Our air is cleaner and our water is cleaner, which California continues to fight. They have many more vehicles to deal with than what we do. I feel at this point it would be a mistake to adopt their emission standards and create a great deal of uncertainty. I feel it would create an island in the Midwest as far as marketing vehicles. An island would tend to create a higher cost to consumers when purchasing different vehicles. When the unknowns become known, a more clear decision can be made. And once again, I would thank the committee for their time.
Any questions, members? Thank you for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any last words, Representative Hortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really briefly, because I know everybody wants to eat something before we're back on the floor, but I passed out a chart that across the top, it says CALLEB 2 emission standards for tailpipe emissions for passenger and non-commercial vehicles. And what it shows you there is the different categories that a vehicle can be certified to by a manufacturer. It can be certified to LEV, LEV option 1, ULEV, or SULEV. And, you know, you heard a lot of concern about whether E85 vehicles can be certified to SULEV today. You heard testimony from Mr. Kiquette that E85 vehicles can be certified to SULEV in the future. But what's important to notice is that there's three categories, and E85 vehicles qualify in the LEV and the ULEV category. And right now, that's two-thirds of the mix. So they don't qualify for one-third of the categories that they could be sorted into, but they do qualify in the other two categories. With regard to the idea of too far, too fast, I think waiting more than 17 years for the United States Congress to act on the federal fuel economy standard shows we can't wait for Washington. Minnesota has been a nation leader in our fuel standards, and I suspect we will continue to be a nation leader in our fuel standards. But in other areas, when another state has done something well and it works, we emulate that standard and we bring it here, whether it's graduated driver's licenses for teenagers or an environmental standard. We use ideas from other states, and we know exactly in black and white what we are adopting today. With regard to the technology, OnStar and the onboard computers are already there. That's not going to be an added cost to the consumer. If you drive a flex fuel vehicle, it has a computer that tells the engine what kind of fuel is coming into the engine so the engine can make the right decisions on how to react. One of our colleagues here told me, OnStar called him in the middle of the day this winter and said, are you okay, sir? And he said, well, why do you ask? And they said, well, we show you in the middle of a lake. This information is already being collected. So if we're concerned about information being collected in our vehicles, that seat has left the barn. Or cow. Except cow would be better, right?
Does the Ag Committee get your terminology right?
Yeah, we don't raise a lot of sheep here in Minnesota, do we?
We have sheep.
California don't, but we do.
And then, Mr. Chair, I know that Mr. Kiquette probably has more detailed responses, but I know that we're short on time. What I would ask you is, do you like seatbelts and do you like airbags? Because if we left the automotive manufacturers to make that decision for us, we would not have those things. In 1970, Lee Iacocca testified that if the Clean Air Act were passed, there would be no domestic auto industry in the United States by 1975. I think the track record is that when we want innovation, whether it's ethanol, seatbelts, or air pollution, we need to be leaders as elected officials.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Hortman, members. I don't know if we've answered questions or created even more, but
hearing. This is the way we do legislation, and we will continue to strive to understand your bill, Representative Portman. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.